Okay, so good to see you again, and very good to be back here at the Buddhist Library. I want to start by just wishing a moment's peace for our friends down the road who are very angry. I know they probably have good reasons to be angry. I'm not exactly sure what they're protesting about today, probably the Spratlys or something. Free Tibet, okay. So, may they find peace. I don't know. It seems so many things to get angry about in the world, and so many good things to get angry about, right? So it's very understandable why people get very angry about these things, but I'm not sure that it's going to be the most effective way to bring about change, but I can certainly understand why people get upset about these things, so I hope that they can find some peace and some resolution. So So here I am again, and we're here in the library, and we're speaking about Buddhism and about suttas and things like that. Oh, and by the way, yeah, I've got laryngitis. So it's kind of getting better a bit, so I can kind of speak today, so that's lucky. But, well, we'll see how it lasts, all right? These things quite possibly could be impermanent. I have a sneaking suspicion that they may be impermanent, so we will see. So you can forgive me if I try to get you guys to talk today and do some meditation and stuff like that. So you might think it's a very nice, good way of engaging with the audience and practicing and things, but for me it's mostly an excuse so that I don't have to talk. Okay. So I spent most of the last 2 years translating Pali. And so this has been an incredible journey for myself. And I've translated the four Nikayas of the Pali Canon. I'm just looking around the room. I think there are a few people who are here. I gave a presentation at the Mitra conference last weekend. There were a few people. How many people were at Mitra conference? Oh, that's quite a few. Because I was wondering whether I should do the same slideshow that I did there. But what do you think? Should I do it again or not? Is it too boring? Do it again? All right. Okay. All right. Thank you. Well, I made a bit of a slideshow because otherwise I forget what I was supposed to talk about. So I hate slideshows. So, but I'll do it anyway. But since the talk at Mitra, we have actually gone live. So this is now the live version of Sutta Central. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So thank you, big, big thank you to all of the developers, programmers, all of the donors, all of the volunteers who have worked on this. An incredible amount of hours of volunteer work have gone into what we've achieved. We've had a team of about 8 developers working pretty much full-time on this for the last 5 months. So it's a complicated website, a complicated piece of software. And software development, if you've ever done it, is really hard. It's really hard, yeah. So if you're thinking about careers, choose another one, because software is, like, really hard. Particularly programming for the web, because when you program for the web, you have to make sure that it runs seamlessly and instantly and flawlessly on billions of devices everywhere around the world. It's completely crazy that anyone should even imagine that that's possible, but here we are. So what we've done is I've translated the four Nikayas, and these are now uploaded. They're part of Sutta Central, and they are freely available, so anybody can use them for other purposes as well. But we said we'd do the slideshow, so let's do the slideshow, and that will give us a bit of background. Let me see. Here we've got the slideshow. Okay. All right. So this is just going to be a basic. I'll try to run through it. I'll try to not take too long to run through it. So what are the suttas, teachings of the Buddha, a spiritual and ethical guide to life, the sacred scriptures of Buddhism, and a path to the end of suffering. So the suttas, and in particular the four Nikayas, have an importance in Buddhism which is probably roughly comparable to that of the four Gospels in Christianity. The difference, of course, being that there's a lot more of them. So here's a very brief recap of the history. So the Buddha's oral teachings were memorized and organized by his disciples. The early texts are the four Nikayas, the six early books of the Kuddhika Nikaya, the six early books being the Dhammapada, Udana, Itivuttaka, Terattarigata, and Suttanipata. All other texts are later. And very similar schools were maintained, collections were maintained by the schools. So Sutta Central contains not only the early, not only the Pali texts, but also the early texts in Chinese, Sanskrit, and Tibetan, which are similar to those found in the Pali texts. These texts were written down roughly 400 years after the Buddha, and both early and late texts were taken to China and Tibet, where they were translated. So most of the translations we have of the early texts are from Chinese, the vast bulk of them, and they were mostly done in China around 400 AD, between 400 and 450 AD. I'm not quite sure why that is, because the texts were being translated in China over about an 800-year period, or nearly 1,000-year period, perhaps even more, and yet almost all of the Agama sutras that we have were translated within a few decades. So I'm not entirely sure why that is. In any case, so there are some texts in Tibetan, but much fewer, and some in Sanskrit and other more obscure Indic languages. Any questions on that before I go on? Huh? Very good. We're going to have a test. Should we have a test at the end? See if you remember everything? No, okay. All right. So here's just some examples of some of the early manuscripts. This particular one is the one of the Gandhari manuscripts. And these were ones which have been recovered from Afghanistan. And in recent years have been published by a team of international scholars, one of whom, Mark Allen, works just down the road here in Sydney Uni. So he's one of the leading scholars in this particular field. When I say one of the leading scholars in the field, I mean there's like three of them. So he's one of the three. You can see that recovering these texts and reading them, because they're all handwritten, right? So each manuscript is written by a different scribe. So each manuscript presents different sort of, you know, orthographic difficulties and sort of trying to recognize them and edit them. And so it's a really difficult task. And here's just here's a Tibetan manuscript. Now, just to give you an example, like of what the kind of thing that when we're talking about the Buddhist scriptures, you know, they were maintained in this form for many years. Just the other day, I was down in the Phokon Shan, the Nantian Buddhist Institute in Wollongong, and we were talking about the with the professors there, Royce and Tamara. We were talking about the different questions of lineage, because they're currently working on digitizing an engraved edition of the Pali Canon from Myanmar, and so we're talking about how difficult it is to find exactly like where these manuscripts come from. Right? We can only trace their history back so far, and to sort of find out where they come from, where this one came, why this was done in this form, and so on. These are things that are not easy to trace. Here's an example of a Pali manuscript. This, of course, is the palm leaf manuscript. And so what they would do with these palm leaf manuscripts is that they would scratch on them with a metal engraver, and then sort of dust ink over it, and so they would keep it in. So this is why you see Burmese and Sri Lankan writing is very curly. Right? See, Sri Lankan, Burmese, Sri Lankan writing is always very curly, because you can't do horizontal lines, because it will split the palm leaves. Right? So this is why they ended up with very curly writing. And it's interesting to remember these things, because these little trivial details of the material form in which the scriptures are passed down influence and shape the manner in which these things happen. For example, because there's those restrictions on letter forms, then that might mean that certain letters are more similar to certain other letters. So they might be more easily mistaken for one for the other. Yeah? So these kinds of things, just like in a digital environment, you know, if you're using a font like Arial, for example, where the capital I and the L look almost identical, right? Then it's very easy to mistake it because of the specific choices that a designer made in designing that particular font, right? So that actually prompts or encourages certain kinds of mistakes to be made. And so the physical manner in which the transmission happens can influence these things. But when thinking about transmission and thinking about the memory of text, right? So what we're talking about is a memory. We're talking about sustaining of information through the ages. And people think that, oh, that written manuscripts are better than oral, or that these kinds are better than that kind, or something like that. But actually, all of these means of transmission are fine, right? Paper is fine. Palm leaf is fine. Memory is fine. Yeah? If you know how to memorize things, it's a perfectly good way of transmitting texts. Digital information is fine, but digital is not better than any of these. Actually, digital has its own traps and its own difficulties. It's very easy to make a systematic change in a digital text where you can suddenly change one character across thousands of texts without even noticing it, right? So all of these things have their own pitfalls and their own advantages, right? So the key criterion in asking the question, how are these things maintained reliably through the generations, the key criterion is how carefully do the people do the work? Yeah? That's what matters. If you're doing the work carefully, then any of these mediums can be perfectly good. Any of these mediums? Media. Any of these media can be perfectly good. Alright. So we come down to modern times. So in the 19th century, texts in Pali, Chinese, Tibetan and Sanskrit were collated and published in book form. Parallels were identified, so the parallels between these different collections were identified by mostly Japanese scholars in the early 20th century. So the beginnings of it was from Nanjio in the mid-19th century, and Samuel Beal also in mid-19th century, and they were the first ones to notice that there were parallels, and they were collated and systematized by the Japanese scholars, especially Aneseki and Akinuma in the early 20th century, and then those were refined and corrected throughout the 20th century by a series of Japanese and Taiwanese scholars, and more latterly by scholars from, well, Queensland, really. So Rob Bucknell, together with Analia from Germany. Pali Text Society has translated almost the whole of the Pali canon, and we were talking about that the other day, again, in the Nanteen Institute, about how kind of funny this is, because you've got all of these English people who are translating the Pali canon. What do they know about Buddhism? Well, nothing, really. Right? So we've kind of entrusted our Buddhist heritage to the Pali Text Society and to their translations, but they really didn't know much about Buddhism, like seriously. And much of the tradition has been kind of riding on the, riding on the coattails of academic prestige. Right? I mean, the Pali Text Society is kind of at Oxford, and you know, and it's kind of it's prestigious, right? So, and apparently it's well known among Pali scholars that the Pali Text Society editions are not very good, but I mean, they vary in quality; some are better than others. But the kicker is that the Pali Text Society readings and interpretations have often been silently reintroduced into the Asian editions from mid-19th century onwards. Right? And that's kind of curious, isn't it? And these things aren't noticed, right? But they're actually there. And so you actually have to go back into the 19th century manuscripts and so on to find manuscript traditions that haven't been contaminated by the English. The word contamination is a technical term in text critical studies. It doesn't refer to viruses. Okay, I'm not suggesting that the English are particularly sickly or anything like that. So that's very interesting to reflect on. You know, when we think about Buddhism as an Asian tradition, but that Asian tradition has been influenced by Western ideas for a long time. So in the 1990s and 2000s, the texts were digitized. Ken, any questions? Not at all. No. Well, there are Pali texts that are not to do with Buddhism, but not that many of them, and they haven't actually published them. I mean, the really interesting ones are the ones to do with Buddhism. There are also Pali texts that are like on history, like the Sri Lankan histories, which have also been done. There's also things like grammars and law books and all kinds of things, you know, books of poetry and various other kinds of things. But, of course, the main focus of them has always been publishing the Buddhist texts. Yeah. Okay, so here's an example of an edition from the Pali Text Society. And just to note the way that they introduce Western conventions, right? So you see here there's footnotes. Right? So footnotes are a particular Western convention. They're bound to the idea of the book because it's a note that appears at the bottom of a page. Right? Titles, right? Titles at the beginning of something. In the Indic tradition, the title's always at the end. So these conventions have been adopted, and in some ways they transform the way that these texts are presented. And you know, other things that you can see, for example, that the text you probably can't see very clearly, but the text has got punctuation and capitalization. Okay? So this is a sentence that ends. The words are broken up, like in the Indic texts. You can see here there's no real break between the words. Right? They're just continual, and there's no real punctuation. So these things are introduced, and of course that's introduced on the judgment of the scholars who did that. And sometimes you get it right, sometimes you get it wrong. So here's another photo. So this is a manuscript from Dunhuang in the west of China, in the desert region there, and an incredible trove of manuscripts of all kinds of things was found, some of which are early Buddhist manuscripts. And so here's an example of one of those being digitized. And this also a very important one. This is the Tripitaka Koryana, and this is a 13th century edition in these incredible wooden blocks, which was carved in Korea. And as you can see from the carving on there, beautifully carved, and incredible craftsmanship and care that went into doing this. And they created these works, and that whole building you can see behind was built in the 13th century to house them. And as you can see, they're still in absolutely pristine condition. So these woodblocks form the basis of all of the modern digital editions of the Chinese texts. Okay, so it's in Korea, but it's the Chinese Buddhist canon. so they, in modern times, they've made rubbings of it. So you get pencil and paper and make rubbings. Three times they've made rubbings of this. One of them lives in Canberra. I don't know why, but it does. So, and then from the rubbings, then they make the printed editions, and from there they make the digital editions. But this is, there are other manuscript sources of the Chinese text, but this has been the most prestigious and the most widely used. So last part of the history, so to central history, started in 2004 by Rod Bucknell, myself, and John Kelly, with support from Venerable Analio, and for the Australians here who were brought up in the same era that I was, yes, John Kelly is Paul's brother. All right? Just so we're clear about that, okay? And in 2005, we put up a simple site with the Sutta parallels and external links to texts. Those external links, most of them broke because the sites went dead. So we rebuilt it, putting the texts on our own website in 2012 and made the whole website a lot cooler and better. And that's been the website which has served us very well up until now and until 2018. And we decided to rebuild the whole website again. And the reason we decided to build again, really, it's just one of those things where you get a sort of an accumulation of different things that you want to do, and by the time you sort of re-architected the old thing, it's easier to just build it again from the scratch, or at least that's what we told ourselves. So so the new website has my translation for the four Pali Nikayas. We have Venerable Brahmali's new translation of the Vinaya, also an incredible work and a much needed one. The previous translation of the Vinaya Pitaka by I.B. Horner is pioneering, shall we say, groundbreaking, and well in need of an update. The texts are segmented, and I'll show you a bit what that means later on. We have an internationalized UI, so you can read it in your own language. We have offline support via progressive web apps. We have lots and lots more parallels, and we have built a third language translation software. So that means that from the English translations that we're making now, we're going to be supporting other people to make translations in third languages. So you have the Pali, the English, and then Sinhala, or Chinese, or Bahasa, or Slovenian, or whatever it might be. So currently we have translations in nearly 40 languages. All of them are incomplete. Many of them are accurate, inconsistent, or hard to understand. And a lot of the translations are, for example, like the when we look at our user data from Thailand, we find that the majority of our users in Thailand read suttas in English. Right? And when we ask our Thai friends, why is that? Why do you read the suttas in English? They say, because it's easier to understand. Yeah? So it's easier for them to understand English than it is to understand the very, very formal and archaic Thai that the translations have been made into. And many translations are encumbered by copyright, so they can't be put freely on the web. So we currently have about 70 million words, 40 languages, about 70,000 texts, and 30,000 parallels, one dhamma. And the characteristics of the new translations are complete and consistent across the four main Nikayas. So this is the first time this has been done, certainly in any European language, and I think it might be the first time in any language, where all four Nikayas are translated consistently. So the same phrase will be translated the same way across all four Nikayas. So previously, Bhikkhu Bodhi's editions would be consistent within one Nikaya, but not from one Nikaya to the next. So that's obviously nice, because the four Nikayas are very much a synoptic group of texts. That is to say, they should be read together. And so they are highly unified. They're constantly referring to each other, and the language and idioms and ideas within those four Nikayas is very much shared. So it's very important, I think, to be able to translate them consistently, so that you know that if you're reading one phrase in one and the same phrase in the other, that they are representing the same Pali text. It's plain modern English. So I made special effort to try to make everything as readable as possible. One of the main reasons for that is because I've lived a lot of my life in Asia, or with Asian people, or with people who have learnt English as a second language. And I know that it's very difficult. All right? And what if, you know, if we've had a good education, if we've had a tertiary education in English, and we can read these two texts, it's not an issue. We don't even notice that a text is a bit harder to read. But if we're learning the language, or our language is the second language, then it's a real struggle, and it makes a real difference if we can simplify the language as much as possible. That doesn't mean dumbing it down. It just means not making it unnecessarily complicated. And it means keeping the sentences short, breaking long sentences into shorter sentences. It means phrasing things so that the key meaning of a sentence usually comes at the start, right? So you don't have to wait to the end of a sentence to figure out what it's about. And so it means giving consideration to all of the things that's going to make life a little bit easier for people who are maybe not so fluent in English. Remember that the largest English-speaking nation in the world today is China. Right? And there are more people in China speak English than in the US. Right? So, in fact, statistically, China is the center of the English language. Right? And England is just some kind of far-flung dialect. Right? So the future of English is Chinglish. Yeah? Make no mistake. The future of English is Chinglish. Get used to it. Right? And if you think that using gendered pronouns is important, forget it. You know, that battle is lost. And it's not just lost because of feminism. Right? It's lost because the Chinese don't have gendered pronouns. It's as simple as that. Yeah, if you try to insist on using gendered pronouns, you lose. Sorry. So this is one of the things that I also did in the translation, no gendered pronouns. So except when the context called for it. So one of the things in Pali, like in traditional English or older forms of English, would tend to use a masculine as a default gender. Whereas, of course, in modern English, we're moving to using a neutral gender as default. And that's the kind of standard writing style in a lot of universities and a lot of places now. So I believe that if we do translations that may retain the gendered pronouns now, it's going to be seen as hopelessly archaic within a very few years. So it's the first translation that avoids gendered pronouns. And in addition to doing these things, I also wrote over 100 essays on various issues regarding the translation, some of which are very boring, even for me, but some of which are actually quite interesting. And so we might have a look at some of those essays later on and see if there's anything worth discussing there. Okay, so I'm just going to now just talk about a few specific issues that came up in the translations. And I should probably, because you guys, probably you were here, so I might just actually, what I might do is skip those, and I might discuss some other issues from the essays later on. So just out of respect for the those who were at the previous presentation, and I'll just finish up with a just a summary. And so people often ask me, like, what did you learn, or what did you bring away from you, bring away with you from those 2 years, and you know, it's not so much that there is a kind of a blinding moment of insight. You know, these are texts that I've lived with for most of my adult life, and I've studied them in translation and the original language many, many times. So it's not like there's a huge huge surprises. I mean, yes, sometimes there are surprises, but it's not so much that. But it's more it's more like the feel and the tone that is transmitted throughout many, many different texts and passages. And that tone, the Buddha, who was so reasonable, who was so clear, who was so kind and compassionate, who always knew the right thing to say. And he wasn't trying to be clever, and he wasn't trying to impress people. And that sense, as is expressed in somewhere like the Udumbarika Sihanada Sutta, where he's speaking to a wanderer, and he says to the wanderer, "You might think that I'm teaching you in order to make you give up your teacher, but do not think that. Let your teacher remain your teacher. You might think that I'm teaching you in order to make you give up your beliefs. Don't think that. Let your beliefs remain as they are. Let your practices remain as they are. I'm only teaching you in order to help you let go of suffering." And that attitude of the Buddha, that way that he conveyed the Dhamma so consistently in so many times to so many people, that to me was the most inspiring thing. So when translating, for the most part, I tried to take myself out of the equation. I mean, you can't do that 100%, but you try to translate in a way that will be fairly where you sort of step aside and try to always put yourself in that idea of saying, well, how, if I was the Buddha saying this now, how would the Buddha say it? And every word, every phrase, you have so much gratitude for all of those people who have passed the Dhamma down to us. I mean, it's just incredible. You know, 2,500 years, what incredible dedication it takes, you know, to be able to get the Dhamma, to pass it down. And that faith, right? And that effort, all that work that's gone into it. And I feel for myself that I've benefited so much from this. I've learned so much that I feel like it's my duty to help to pass it down to future generations, and to try to serve the Dhamma in that way. And so that, you know, we don't feel that, you know, it's not a question of ownership. It's not a question of trying to sort of promote one version of Dhamma over another version of Dhamma. I would really think that the world would be a bit of a better place if a few people read some more suttas and put them into practice. So this was the motivation behind what I was doing. So that's my very brief slideshow for you. And I'd just like to open up if there's any questions. Thank you. He founded the Pali Text Society, yes. Yeah. It was his idea. Yeah. Oh, very much so, yeah. Yeah. Right. Chinese history is big and complicated in Hong Kong. I don't know much about it. But Buddhism first started arriving in China about 400 years after the Buddha. Something like that. So not all that long. Maybe 300 years. The first text we have date from around that time. So presumably there was some contact before that. Remembering that from the time of Ashoka, about 158 years after the Buddha, that there was the beginning of the large-scale trade between India and Rome, or Greece and Rome, and then not long after with China as well. So that was really the era where that sort of pan-Eurasian trade routes were started up. So the trade with China would have begun about 100 BC or something roughly like that, and Buddhism would have followed along with the trade routes, both the sea route and the land route. But the thing about that is, of course, China is so big, so Buddhism's arriving, you know, it's not like, have you ever met a Buddhist, right? It's not like it's organized or anything, right? Some monk jumps on a boat and then arrives at a port in China and then gets off and, you know, talks to people, yeah. And then somebody else comes on a caravan across the desert, and they're like in another city in China 1,000 miles away, and they both come from completely different backgrounds, and this one maybe translates one text, and this one translates another one, right? And then sort of, you know, so that whole thing, and that, so, and because China was already a very complex society, so different people within that society were interested in different aspects of it, right? So, you know, there might be some people who are interested, who'd been influenced by the Taoist tradition and the contemplative tradition, and they might be more interested in the meditative side of things, or the Confucian people might be more interested in the ethics side of things, and so on and so forth. And then there might be intellectuals and philosophers who'd be interested in the philosophy. So it's not like it sort of got received as Buddhism, you know, it got received as these different kinds of things, and Mahayana sutras coming in one place, and Vinaya texts coming in the other place. And so there's all these things, and it took hundreds of years to come to like a Chinese synthesis of Buddhism, of an understanding of like a coherent practice of Buddhism. And that happened about 400 to 500 AD, where the sort of the first generations of Chinese sort of great Chinese masters put together overarching pictures of Buddhism from their perspective. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm intrigued that Tanaka could have managed to use generalist
Yeah, mostly they there or you. I tried avoiding one as much as possible because I don't like it. It's really kind of formal and stuff. Yeah, but sometimes you have to use it. Yeah. So it's a bit of an adventure, you know. Some phrases work better than others, and you have to sort of experiment around. But I think it might take a little while to sort of get used to it and sort of wear down some of the sort of gnarly edges and figure out what the best approach to things is. But I'm pretty happy with it for the most part. Yeah. I really just tried to translate it so it would be understandable. That's my main thing. No, it's not a scholarly emphasis, and I think that one of the problems with translations of texts is that they tend to be done by Buddhist scholars for other Buddhist scholars. And this is something which has been pointed out often in Western Buddhist studies. So you have in Buddhist studies, you have this concept of what they call Buddhist hybrid Sanskrit, which is kind of like Sanskrit, but kind of with Buddhist characteristics, so it's not really Sanskrit. And so some modern scholars talk about Buddhist hybrid English. So it's kind of like English, but not as we know it. And so English as used by Buddhist scholars is its own particular dialect of English. So I tried to translate just for a general audience. And I tried to look at each sentence and try to say, what if someone's not an expert, not a Pali scholar, not a Buddhist scholar, and they looked at this sentence, would they come away with a reasonable idea of what this sentence is about? Yeah. Venerable sir. I could, but I'm not sure if it's going to be. That wasn't one of the sutras that I translated. So, right. Okay. Okay. Yeah, look, I can have a look, but this wasn't one of the ones that I translated.
Yeah.
So I haven't studied that in depth, unfortunately. Can you remember the number? Uragavaga. So I'm in the Uragavaga. There we go. The Pali text. So this is the translation of this one is by ex venerable Kandipala. I edited. Switch this one? Right. All right, yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah, that looks like a bad mistake, doesn't it? This has a variant reading, so you see the variant. Yeah. So this is one of the things. Anyway, I can just show you what some things we can do. So with one of the texts on Sutta Central, we have some variant readings. So in the picture we saw before of the Pali Text Society edition, we saw the footnotes that they had. So the footnotes record various variant readings. And so on sort of central, we retain various variant readings, and these are indicated like this. So you can just hover over it, and you can see, as Venerable pointed out, in the main text, basically says sui jano, so somebody who has good understanding, has good luck or good fortune, or things go well for them. But then sui jano, but things go badly for someone who's also sui jano, which should be that they're, hang on, a wise person, things go well, and for a wise person, things go badly. Hang on. So somebody slipped up. But in the variant reading, you can see that it has the correct reading, or the expected reading anyway, of dubi jano, which would mean if you're unwise, then things will go badly. So, it's interesting that that's a very obvious mistake, and it's interesting that the editors, normally this edition is edited very carefully. It's interesting that they didn't pick that up. Right. Exactly, yeah. Yeah. Thank you for that. I'll make sure... I still plan to translate Sutta Nipata at some point in the future, so I'll make sure to look out for that one. Yeah. Okay, very good. Thank you. Other questions? Yes. Yes. Right. Yes. Yes. Very much so. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about that. So I'll just give a bit of background information first so people know what we're talking about. So we mentioned before that there are these Chinese translations, and these Chinese translations were collections of texts which were very similar to that in the Pali, not identical, but very similar. And they were brought to China roughly around 400 or 50 AD, most of them, and there they were translated. And the translation process was usually that they would have a manuscript, and that manuscript, they would have one reciter, who might often be an Indian monk, and then maybe a Chinese monk who's doing the translating, and another one or two who might be doing the scribing. So they'd usually have like a small little translation team of maybe three or four monks who would do that work. And a lot of those details are usually recorded in the Chinese text. So the Chinese textual tradition was very meticulous, and so they very often recorded the dates that this was done, the city in which it was done, and who did it. And then all of that information was then collated in catalogs. Okay, so we showed you before the Tripitaka Koreana and that big building filled with things. So one whole section of that is the catalogs. So there's whole catalogs of catalogs, right, that people have done over the years, and these multiple catalogs of all of the texts. This is why we're able to do a lot of dating in the Chinese sphere much more accurately than in the Indian sphere, because they always dated things relevant to the emperor and so on. Whereas in the Indian sphere, if you want to date a text, it's always probably somewhere in the first few centuries AD is probably about as accurate as we can get. Whereas in the Chinese, we're often able to date it to the precise year or even to the part of the year, you know, in early 403 or something like that. So these texts were translated into Chinese. And in Sutta Central, you can see these Chinese texts here. The languages are indicated in the icons on the side. And the whereas in Pali, we have the Digha Nikaya. And the Chinese, we have the Dirghagama. And we also have this other category here for other Dirgha Suttas. And what that means is that in Chinese, basically that as well as the main collection, which they would take over and translate, they also had the individual suttas that might be translated here and there. So you can imagine it's a bit similar to what you might have in the library here, where you might have like Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation of the Majjhima Nikaya, and you might have another few books with like individual suttas from the Majjhima Nikaya, which have been put in there here and there from other different authors and so on. And so they're collected in the other Dirgha Suttas category. And if we have a bit of a look at that here on Sutta Central, so here, first of all, the translation situation is not nearly as good with the Chinese texts as with the Pali texts. So with the Pali texts, This is the list of translations that we have. Okay, for the first sutta there. So as you see, a lot of different translations. Whereas with the Chinese text, we just got the Chinese and Vietnamese translation. Okay, so that's the first thing, is that so much less work has been done. And congratulations, I must say, to our Vietnamese friends who have done incredible work. And Vietnamese translations of early Buddhist texts are more complete than any other language, including English. So if we look at the Chinese text, so again, remembering that these Chinese texts are the digitized versions of the text of those, the Tripitaka Koreana that we saw before in that big building. And so this is what the digitized text actually looks like. So then to come to the point that was being made earlier, that we have the same kinds of issues. So you can see here that this text introduces punctuation, right, commas and so on. And so this is like, thus have I heard, at one time the Buddha was staying, and so on and so forth. And so this is the Buddha addressing the monks, O monks, and then going on. And so these punctuations were introduced into the modern Chinese editions in much the same way as they were introduced into the modern English or Western editions of the Pali texts. And as with the Pali texts, the punctuation is of variable quality. So in certain editions, the punctuation is quite good and quite useful. But in other editions, then it's quite poor. There might be no punctuation at all, or the punctuation that's there is quite misleading. So it's important when reading it to be aware that the punctuation is no more than a rough guide indicated by the editor of that particular manuscript. Yep. Do you want to make any other comments about that? No? That's good. Yeah, Barbara. Primarily, yeah, it was done from the translation's done from the text of the Mahasangiti edition, which is a Burmese edition, and that's the one that we have on Sutta Central. So the Mahasangiti edition is the best edited, most carefully edited digital edition that's available at the moment. And that's the one that we use as our basis. It's not necessarily to say it's the most accurate or authentic, but it's certainly the most best edited and most consistent. Most, you know, there's not many typos and those kinds of things. And I would refer to other editions in difficult cases. Yes, refer to the Pali Text Society edition occasionally. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Okay, yeah. It is, yeah. Okay. So here we have the suttas, and under the sutta, the long, middle, linked, and numbered. So this is the four Nikayas. So these are the ones that I've translated. Okay, and then next we have the minor, which is the Khuddaka Nikaya, and the other, which is various other kinds of obscure things, fragments and things. So under the minor ones, we have the Khuddaka Nikaya. And so this is the fifth Nikaya in Pali. Right? And it consists of this long list of books. So in fact, the Khuddaka means the little Nikaya, but in fact it's very big. All right? And the reason for that is because it grew over time. It probably started out small and then got very big. And most of these editions are quite late. So, for example, Melinda Panha was dated from the time of King Mananda, which is about 100 BC, and it was expanded after that. So that's dated about 400 years after the Buddha. The Neti and Petika Padesa probably about the same time. Patisambhidamagga also probably 300 or 400 years after the Buddha, and so on. So some of them are quite late, but certain of these books are quite early, and the ones that are usually considered to be relatively early are the Dhammapada, so six books, the Dhammapada, one, the Udana. The Dhammapada in Pali is just the verses. So the stories are all part of the commentary. Okay? So the commentary is later, but the verses themselves are early. Udana, Itivuttaka. Itivuttaka is like a sort of small little Anguttara Nikaya. The Sutta Nipata, another collection of poems, mostly poems. These two are later, and then the Theragata, the verses of the monks, and the Therigata, the verses of the nuns. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So those six are regarded as the six early books of the Kudika Nikaya. Yeah. I think so, yeah. I think all of those texts are likely to primarily stem from the time of the Buddha, or maybe a little bit later in some cases. I mean, we know that some of them were a little bit after the time of the Buddha. But they have doctrinally... See, the thing is that to stratify these things is not difficult. Like, doctrinally, it's almost shocking how quickly and how completely the teaching changed. Like seriously, if you look at a book like the Theragata, and the Theragata, the verses of the monks and nuns in the time of the Buddha, and a verse after verse of verse says, you know, here I am, I've become enlightened, I've been living in the forest, I've been dedicated to meditation, I've been practicing mindfulness, I've been following this life of seclusion, and I've managed to let go of all of my attachments, and now I've experienced the bliss and the peace of awakening. And again and again we find verses like this. In the Tara Apadana, which is telling the past, the later book telling the past lives of the monks, again and again we find nothing of that, nothing of any of that, and we find, oh, I was so lucky in the time of the past Buddha so-and-so that I could offer a bunch of flowers to this Buddha, and as a result of the merit that I made from giving dana, then I got enlightened in this life. Right? And that shift is not a gradual or a small one. It's almost total and like black and white between the two texts. There's almost no overlap. There's a little bit of overlap, but not much. Right? So when we talk about the earlier and the later texts, doctrinal content is one criteria. That's probably the most important one, but as well as the language and the style and all of those kinds of things. So the texts which come from that early period, they all have that similar flavour. And they all have that sort of focus on that Dhamma that we know and we recognize as the teachings of the Buddha. Yeah.
What caused this shift, the sudden shift?
Well, that would be more speculative. Many things. The popularization of Buddhism, it was spread among a lot more people. Perhaps... if I was to be cynical, I would say that they had big monasteries and they needed to have lots of donations, so they made lots of texts about saying how good it is to make donations, but that would just be very cynical, so I wouldn't say that. If I was a cynical person, I would say that. Not being a cynical person, I wouldn't say that. it's just that's what happens. You know, I mean, you see that all the time. We shouldn't be surprised by it. You know, every religion, you know, look what happened to Christianity, it's the same thing. You know, Jesus teaching his whole life, teaching about, you know, being humble and being kind and all of these kinds of things. And then he dies and then immediately becomes a religion about getting a blessing because you receive the physical body of eating of the dead God. Like, what's that got to do with anything that he actually said ever? Right? So it doesn't take time. You know, I heard a story from a very good friend of mine, Venerable Pasmo in Bodhinyana, who's an American, and he was one of the first American Buddhist monks ordained in America as a Zen monk in the 1960s. And his teacher was, I can't remember, someone Roshi in San Francisco, one of the famous Zen Roshis there. And he at that time was very close with his teacher, and he actually, he's a very funny guy, but he showed up at the door as this kind of, you know, dirty hippie with long hair and stuff, and then the Roshi answered the door, and he said, I'm going to stay here and ordain and become a monk with you. and learn with you and practice at your feet. And the Roshi said, okay, well, look, we've got a meditation group on Wednesday. Why don't you come along and do some meditation? He said, no, 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 you don't understand. I'm going to come here and live with you and become a monk with you, right? And that's what he did. And he was very close with the Roshi, and he lived and practiced with him for years. And one of the Roshi's practices was every day to look after the Zen garden. Right? So they would go out together, and they would tend the garden just very mindfully and very carefully. And that's something that they always did as a kind of a mindfulness practice every day. And then the Roshi died, and they had the funeral. And the next day, he came out to tend the Zen garden and to sweep it up and things like that. And then the followers said, no, 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 you can't touch that. That's the Roshi's garden. Yeah? Yeah? One day. That's how much it took. Yeah? One day. And it's gone from being a living tradition to being a fossil. Yeah? One day. So, religion always has these aspects, you know, these aspects of tradition, which is about the maintaining of something from the past, and so we want to maintain that which is best and most valuable from the past, but also there has to be a renewal, right? And there has to be a revitalization, because those things which were fresh and meaningful in that time have become fossils. And so that they have to be continually broken open and continually given new life. Otherwise, we're just handing down fossils from one generation to the next. Okay. How early? Well, it's really impossible to date these things exactly. Personally, I think that the verses of the Dhammapada mostly go back to the Buddha. There might be a few spoken by disciples in the years after that. Some people argue that it's a bit later than that, but I haven't really seen any convincing arguments to that effect. Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of Dhammapadas, and we now have a whole bunch of Dhammapadas. So the official term is a magnitude of Dhammapadas, perhaps what would you say, a magnitude, a colossal of Dhammapadas? Anyway, so there's a whole lot of them. And like with all of the literature, then they have many things in common and many things different. Which is the most authentic one? Take your pick, really. I mean, the Pali has as good a claim as being the most authentic one as any. Certainly the Udanavarga is the Sanskrit version from the Sarvastivadin Garden School. And the Udanavarga is very nice. But it's about twice as long as the Pali, and doesn't have any, you know, it's clearly somewhat later. I'm just trying to see if there's anything. Okay, so here's a verse in the Sanskrit Dhammapada, which those of you who know the Pali Dhammapada should be familiar with it. Anitya bhata sanskara utpada dvaya dharmina utpadya hi nirudhyante te shang vu pashama sukham. Right? Recognize that? Yeah? Yes, so you can translate? Someone translate. Right. Yeah? Upadya. Yeah? Vu pashama sukham. Yeah, so that's the Pali version. So all conditions are impermanent. They're liable to rise and fall. Having arisen, they pass away, and their stilling is happiness. Right? So that's virtually, you know, it's just a slightly different dialect to the Pali, but virtually identical. And this is another very famous verse from the Dhammapada. Right? So this one's a little bit less known, but this is one of my favorites. Ko nuhaso ko anando. Evang pajarite sati. What is joy? What is laughter when the world is ever burning? Shrouded by darkness, would you not seek the light? So you can see that the similarities, and when we talk about these parallel texts, we're not talking about a generic or vague similarity. It's not just they have similar themes or ideas or something. We're talking about texts that have like a word for word identical over thousands and thousands of texts with differences that are almost always minor and inconsequential. And so there might be some differences in the phrasing might differ a little bit, or the sequence of words might be shifted around and those kinds of things. But the underlying texts are really very similar. So this one, I'm not sure where that's from. That's a very new one. And then this is the Patna, very famous Patna Dhammapada. This is from Gandhari, but it doesn't look like we've got the actual text there. So I'll just see if I find another one that we've got the text for. Anyone speak Chinese here? Okay, excellent. We have a Chinese scholar. Excellent. So we'll make full use of that. And so here's one of the Chinese Dhammapadas. This one is actually being translated into English. So here it is. So do you want to translate the first verse for me? Go on, try. You see, I did all that work, right? I come up with lots of difficult sentences. I didn't get to say, oh, this one's a bit difficult, I'm going to skip it. Come on.
Without the dictionary,
I'm going to skip the first one. All right. One second. Let me just see. I've blown it up a bit too big. It's not working properly. Let me see. But we should have this. That will help you. Undefined. Oh, that's no good. Oh, no, it's all broken. Oh, no. That's bad.
I'm not responsible for anything that I made.
Who is then? Go on. So it's the same verse as we just saw in the Sanskrit, yeah? No, that's good. That's good. Thank you so much. Very good. Yeah, excellent. So reading these ancient Chinese is not easy, right? It's like, you know, it's like in English, if you wanted to read Chaucer or something like that, it takes a bit of getting used to. So, thank you for that. So that's something that we'd really love to see, would be some more translations of the Chinese Agamas into modern Chinese. Yeah, that would be really useful. Okay. Mostly. In some cases, they translate directly from the Pali, but that's very random. For example, in Norway, there's an excellent Pali scholar in Norway who's sort of been quietly making translations for many years, and so most of the Pali suttas are in Norwegian. Not sure how many there are, but the ones that are translated are translated very well directly from the Pali. So that's quite random, isn't it? We wouldn't expect necessarily that Norway would have those good texts, but that just happens to be that there was somebody there who was doing that work. And whereas in other countries it might be quite different. So what we want to try to support, it's not necessarily you can't expect there to be that many sort of Pali scholars in all of these different languages. Even in the sphere of, say, Bible studies, for example, they do the same thing. So the main translations are usually done into English, and then they're translated from English into other languages. Google Translate does the same thing. Right? So if you translate from French to Chinese in Google Translate, you actually go from French to English, English to Chinese, English to Chinese to English, English to French, right? Which might explain a thing or two about how it works. So what we try to do is we provide an interface, which I might show you a bit later. I won't try to set it up right now because it might be a bit dodgy. I'm not sure if we're going to get it to work. But what we try to do is get a... I'm just trying to recall which one of these actually works. English. I think it's... Is it Estonian? We had an Estonian friend who wanted to translate, so we set some up in Estonian. Does this work? The Estonian one works. So when I talked about the third language translations, and that this is how this would work. So this is Pootle. This is the translate. This is the software that I've been living with for the past 2.5 years. So this is how I did all my translations. And this is an example of a Estonian translation on Pootle. So you can see it has the Pali texts, and you can hover over that and get the dictionary meanings from the Pali texts. And you have the English translation, and then you can do your Estonian translation there. And so on and so forth. Yeah, so that's how that works. Yeah.
You mentioned you
use
the Burmese pilot.
Yes. All of them come from were in oral tradition for hundreds of years and then written down. So they all come from that written down tradition. And presumably that written down tradition is always ultimately from the Sri Lankan tradition at the Aluvihara. So the particular Burmese recension that we're doing was the one from the Sixth Council, and before the Sixth Council there was the Fifth Council in late 19th century Burma, and that one was inscribed in stone in Burma, and so that was one that the scholars at the Nanteen Institute and Sydney Uni are working on at the moment, creating a new edition. The variations from one edition to the other are very small, it's not like they're it's not like there are kind of major issues, but there are always kind of little details. And as we saw before, sometimes it's, you look at one and it's fairly obvious which one is correct, but there might be some others where it's, it's quite obscure and you have to make a bit of a guess. Yeah. Yeah.
Having spent over 2 years involved in this
I don't know. I mean, one thing that I kind of noticed over those years was because I'm on my island, I'm doing these things, I'm not really talking to things, to people and stuff, but I sort of read the paper in the morning and I see some of the events that have been happening over the past couple of years. And in some ways, you can see what seems to be a kind of a debasement of civil discourse in the world, in that people seem to have lost the art of speaking kindly and politely to each other. And the idea that you can actually have different parties who can sit down together and have a sensible discussion about their differences and try to resolve them in a way that's useful to both parties, and these kinds of things, which, I don't know, seem fairly basic to me, but and perhaps it's just perception, I don't know, but it just seemed more and more that we're kind of losing touch with that idea, and it becomes sort of people become more separated and more sort of throwing ideological positions at each other rather than actually engaging in any kind of reasonable dialogue. And then I could see turning from that and then looking at how the Buddha spoke and how the Buddha spoke not just with Buddhists, and this is one of the outstanding features in the early texts, is how many of them deal with interreligious dialogue, right? And this is again one of the things which is almost a black and white dividing line between early Buddhist texts and all other Buddhist texts, is that early Buddhist texts are fundamentally interreligious. They constantly have the Buddha and other disciples in conversation with Brahmins, in conversation with ascetics, in conversations with skeptics, in conversations with householders, all kinds of people who weren't Buddhists, who, and that whole kind of spectrum between people who are outwardly antagonistic and trying to destroy Buddhism, to people who are a bit skeptical, to people who were pretending they were skeptical just for the sake of having a good argument, right? And then other people were, interested but not convinced, and so on and so forth. Whereas all later Buddhism is Buddhists talking to other Buddhists, right? And I don't, someone please tell me if there's an exception, but I can't think of any exceptions to that. Which is quite stunning, really, when you think about that. Huh? All the later history of Buddhist teachings and philosophies is Buddhists talking to other Buddhists. And again, that dividing line is very sharp. It just stops right there. Like even something like the Melinda Panhara's is a series of debates, and it's a very interesting, lively debate, but it's a Buddhist king having a debate with a Buddhist monk. Whereas in the suttas, it's a Buddhist monk having a debate with a Brahmin or with a skeptical philosopher or, anyone, venerable. Right. Well, the tenth part is like the PhD. That's like the PhD mugger, right? But I think that, the Eightfold Path is the key expression of the path. And then the last two factors are the... I think primarily that the Eightfold Path is especially for leading up to stream entry and that kind of knowledge of the seeing the Dhamma and the vision of the Dhamma, and then the Arhat possesses the last two factors. Yeah. Ah, right. That is a very interesting question. So the question Venerable is asking is one that's been asked many times before, because the Buddha practiced with his former teachers. Let's have a look at that. Practice with the former teachers is in what suttas? Someone got a number for me? Are they going to make me do all the work again? Was it MN26? Is that right? Let's see if I'm right. Yes, I was right. Okay, so here's the very famous story about how the Buddha's going forth and practice with his former teachers, Alarika Lama and Uddhaka Ramaputta. Actually, no, sorry. Let's stop. I will answer that question, but I will answer it after a break, because we've been going on a little bit too long now. Let's stop, have a bit of a break, and then we can come back. We might even do some meditation after the break, and then continue to talk soon. Because if I start on this will go for quite a while. So
before we raise the question about the Buddha's practice with his former teachers. This is a very interesting passage, and one of the best known passages in Buddhism, so let's have a look and see what it says. I'll take the opportunity to show you some of the approaches and the methods that are used when translating. And here you can see my new translation on the left, and the Pali text from the right. So this is the Pali text they use, and these are matched segment by segment. And just so you can see, there are some of the nice things that we can do with this. And we can turn them on like that with the segment numbers, and then you can make a bookmark of that number and share that. So we can now sort of share, if you want to sort of have a particular quote or verse or passage or something like that, then you can share that specific passage, a specific phrase. Whereas in the past, we're often referencing something by a sutta or a page number or something, and we often sort of consistently through these segments. But I'll take that off now because we don't really need it. So, we have this passage down here on the left. Who wants to read the passage out? I don't.
Sure.
Who wants to say my voice? Who wants to have compassion and show me that they can read the passage out for me? Who is going to be the compassionate one? We'll start with here on this one later, and I think it's probably the whole of this. I should be going on the first 13. Where's my phone? Let's refresh that. Couple of paragraphs.
Sometime later, while still black-haired, blessed with youth in the prime of life, though my mother and father wished otherwise, weeping with tearful faces, I shaved off my hair and beard, dressed in ochre robes, and went forth from the lay life to homelessness. Once I had gone forth, I set out to discover what is skillful, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace. I approached Alara Kalama and said to him, Reverend Kalama, I wish to live the spiritual life in this teaching and training. Alara Kalama replied, Stay, Venerable. This teaching is such that a sensible person can soon realize their own tradition with their own insight and live having achieved it. I quickly memorized that teaching. So far as lip recital and oral recitation were concerned, I spoke with knowledge and the authority of the elders. I claimed to know and see, and so did others. Then it occurred to me, it is not solely by mere faith that Alara Kalama declares, I realize this teaching with my own insight and live having achieved it. Surely he meditates knowing and seeing this teaching. So I approached Alara Kalama and said to him, Reverend Kalama, to what extent do you say you realize this teaching with your own insight? When I said this, he declared the dimension of nothingness. Then it occurred to me, it's not just Alara Kalama who has faith, energy, mindfulness, immersion, and wisdom. I too have these things. Why don't I make an effort to realize the same teaching that Alara Kalama says he has realized with his own insight? I quickly realized that teaching with my own insight and lived having achieved it. So I approached Alara Kalama and said to him, Reverend Kalama, have you realized this teaching with your own insight up to this point and declare it having achieved it? I have, Reverend. I too, Reverend, have realized this teaching with my own insight up to this point and live having achieved it. We are fortunate, Reverend, so very fortunate, to see a venerable such as yourself as one of our spiritual companions. So the teaching that I've realized with my own insight and declare having achieved it, you've realized with your own insight and live having achieved it. The teaching that you've realized with your own insight and live having achieved it, I've realized with my own insight and declare having achieved it. So the teaching that I know you know and the teaching that you know, I am like you and you're like me. Come now, Reverend, we should both lead this community together. And that is how my teacher, Alara Kalama, placed me, his student, on the same position as him and honored me with lofty praise. And then it occurred to me, this teaching doesn't lead to disillusionment, fading away, cessation, peace, insight, awakening, and extinguishment. It only leads as far as rebirth in the dimension of nothingness. Realizing that this teaching was inadequate, I got disillusioned and left.
Thanks, Mark. I think that was excellent. So this is the passage is then repeated for the, with some interesting changes, but mostly repeated for Uddhika Ramaputta, the second of the Buddhist teachers. So here we see this is kind of a very famous encounter, an encounter which is remembered in the all of the different Buddhist traditions, and this particular passage is found many times in different texts in Chinese, Tibetan, Sanskrit, and so on, with very few variations. And it has a number of interesting features, or raises a number of interesting questions. Number one question is, who is this fellow, Lamaka Lama? Yeah. A clearly respected teacher, clearly somebody following one of the religious traditions who was in India before the Buddha came along. But which one? Yeah. I mean, it's India, right? You can hardly turn around a corner or trip over a log without running into a different kind of religious movement of some kind. So there are many different religious practitioners, many different types of religious practitioners in those days, just as there are today. And in those times, the sort of two main streams of religious practitioners were what they called the Shramana movement, the ascetic movement, of which the Buddha was one, and he regarded himself as one. And then there was the Brahmanical movement, which followed the Vedas and the Vedic practitioners. Now, of course, there was crossover between these, and mutual inspiration and also criticism between the different groups, but that was generally how it was seen. So that group, the Samanas and Brahmins, were the two main groups of religious practitioners in India at the time of Buddha. And in fact, sort of interesting linguistical, grammatical detail, in later years, the Indian grammarian, I believe it was, Patanjali analyzed the compound Samana Brahmana, ascetics and Brahmins, and he pointed it out as an example of compound consisting of two elements where the two elements are constantly at war with each other. Right? Because the Samanas and Brahmins were always arguing with each other. So the first question is, well, who's the Lamaka Lama? Is he a Brahmin? Or is he from one of the Samana traditions? And we don't have a definitive answer to this, which might seem a little bit odd. But in my view, there's a fairly strong reason to think that Lamaka Lama and Uddhika Ramaputta were in fact Brahmins and were following the Brahmanical Upanishadic philosophy. So they were yogis in the Upanishadic tradition. There are other interpretations of this, but I think that there are. I personally think that's on fairly firm ground to say that. So he approached this a yogi following in the Upanishad tradition, which was the most refined, or one of the most refined and powerful of the philosophies and spiritual paths that was present in India that things today, and he wanted to practice with him. So, and there's a lot of really nice details in this. That lovely phrase by Lamaka Lama, stay in the form, yeah, we have it down there as well. And these kinds of details I find really, really delightful, you know. It's a feeling that it's a spiritual seeker, and they greet you with such warmth and acceptance. And again, I think this is something that you still find a lot, both in India, but also in the different temples and throughout Asia and so on, this sort of kind of warmth. If you see a spiritual seeker shows up at the door, we'll do some meditation, please stay, please come, and we'll give you a heart. We don't have much, but what we have we'll share with you, and you can come and stay with us. That's one aspect which is interesting. The other aspect which is interesting is the fact that Lamaka Lama is saying right out of the bat that you can realize this teaching for yourself. That's an experiential teaching. It's not just an intellectual teaching. Yeah? And so this, again, is a very powerful aspect of that. And Buddha's account of this clearly makes that distinction. Right? So he says that he quickly memorized that teaching. So quickly memorized it. As far as lip recital and oral recitation were concerned, I spoke with the knowledge and authority of the elders. So the knowledge and authority of the elders, interestingly enough, is Theravada. and the word here is Theravada. This is the only place that the word Theravada appears in the early scriptures. And so here it refers to the tradition or the authority of the elders. But then realizing it's not by mere faith that the Lama Lama declares that he knows it. So this word Sadamataka, which you can see here, has this sense of mere faith. Sadamataka. And it's an interesting little linguistic detail because it's the kind of linguistic nuance which sounds quite modern. Right? So from a scientific point of view, you might be kind of used to hearing people talking in this kind of way, or you know, that's just faith, right? You're hearing that you're basing it just on faith rather than on knowledge. And so when we translate these things, it's important that we don't impose those modern ideas on those texts, right? But in this particular case, this isn't a modern imposition on the text, it's what the text is actually saying. The phrase mataka means mere, or it's a diminutive sense, right? So it's saying it's not just by faith. So that idea is actually found within the text itself. So this is kind of one of the things that I'm always kind of trying to be mindful of when translating, is to not impose my own ideas on the text as much as possible, but to try to really listen to it. And translation is a task of listening to the details, to the nuances of what each particular phrase is saying. Not just by mere faith. And also just to mention that is that is also an accurate representation of the Brahmanical scriptures of the time, because the Brahmanical scriptures of the time said the same thing. They said that you shouldn't just pass these scriptures down by mere faith. And this is absolutely the leitmotif of the Upanishads. Ya Evam Veda. They're constantly saying, Ya Evam Veda, one who knows this, right? When you're doing the recitation, if you're doing the rituals, whatever practices you're doing, somebody might do it mindlessly without understanding and just repeat these texts. But the one who does it with knowledge, Ya Evam Veda, they are the one who truly understands and who truly gets the benefit of it. So that emphasis on knowledge and understanding, right, that we know as characteristic of the Buddha's teachings, right, it certainly is characteristic of the Buddha's teachings, but it's not only characteristic of the Buddha's teachings. It's also found in the Upanishadic tradition, and it's represented here in that way in the Buddhist text, and it's also found in that way in the Upanishads themselves. Kind of the foundation and principle in a lot of the Upanishadic texts is that they're taking these rituals which have been passed down for such a long time, and they're imbuing new meaning and new depth and new resonance with them. And so they're constantly bringing this idea of Ya Evam Veda, Ya Evam Veda, wanting all of this. Okay. So then he goes up to Larika Lama and says, okay, what have you got, right? So he's not shy to ask him, like, what's his, and so he declares the dimension of nothingness, akinchaya yatana. So often translated as the base of nothingness, but I think the dimension of nothingness sounds more sci-fi as well. But also still sounding more sci-fi, this actually is again, actually very literal translation. Like the word ayatana means like a spreading out or a dimension, literally dimension, right? So a dimension of nothingness. So Alarika Lama has faith, energy, mindfulness, immersion, and so I'm using immersion as a translation for samadhi and wisdom. Okay, and most of these translations are familiar. Samadhi, of course, most familiar translation is concentration, which I really dislike. So I'm trying out by translating it as immersion. So I'm not sure if it works or not, but anyway, that's what I've got. Yeah? I think it's a bit of a while to get used to it, but once you get used to it, I think it's okay. Yeah. So the idea is that it's like an immersive experience, right? So you're completely wrapped up in that experience, and that's the whole world. Yeah.
What
are
the alternatives you can take? That's quite interesting.
Oh, goodness. well, there's concentration, composure, coalescence, unification, convergence, Because it's one of those things, because unification is more literally ekagata or ekodi bhava, which is also used in that sort of form. And so that's an explanation. So it's like samadhi means unification of mind. So you can't say unification means unification of mind. So sometimes these things are the tricky things.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I'm using that for jhana. So it's another advantage of using immersion, because immersion and absorption are very similar in meaning. So I thought, because they're kind of in the same kind of semantic field, so it would be useful.
Isn't the nothing
is
dimension of nothing
except
the jhana, the higher jhana?
Well, unknown attainment is not actually called the jhana, and such as. Yeah, so none of the higher attainments is pretty interesting. It's under this when you're flying, because when you're on an airplane, mm-hmm. how easy there and this road. Well, the road sort of adopts a fairly tangential relationship to your body in some kind of way, and then you get up, you put a wrap on, and everyone sort of pulling their bags down and looking at all the stuff. Anyway.
Do
you consider Ajahn Chah's teaching of still flowing water as a kind of samadhi, and do you consider that can be translated as immersion?
Something like that, yeah.
So that is also like included in immersion in this world?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of reluctant to specify too exactly, but yeah. And, you know, there's a lot of imagery in the sutras that talks about, like, a lotus which is growing underneath the water and then soaking through with the water. It's like a pleasure which sort of permeates your whole being in your meditation.
Yeah, Ajahn Chah's teaching of still flowing water basically means the mind is calm, but the things are changing, the objects are changing.
Right.
So you can also describe that with immersion?
I think he's more talking about a sort of constant mindfulness at that point. I'm just a bit reluctant to say because it's not always easy to sort of map the things we find in the suttas with different things that are found taught by modern teachers. And so if we want to understand what's taught by the modern teachers, it's really important to spend time within that world and really try to figure out what exactly that they're saying and what that means and what the role of that is within that particular context. And if we sort of in too much of a hurry to say, oh, this means this and this means that, then we can often fail to listen to what it is that they're actually saying. Mm-hmm.
Because I just read the Sermon of Sariputta in the suttas, and yeah. He compared different kind of samadhi, and at last, he said the common things among all the samadhi is that the best of them is the unmovable release of mind.
Yeah.
So, do you consider that condition as the same as the immersion?
Well, immersion and samadhi is a somewhat broader term, which in the suttas usually includes all the four jhanas, the four formless dimensions. And a few other things as well. So it's kind of umbrella terms for all of those things. But it always refers to a higher attainment of meditation. It doesn't just mean sort of meditation generally. Yeah.
I think in Sanskrit, we have the word for you got Sama, and you need to be established.
Right.
Suggest the
source meaning of what actually stands. So we get the literal, actual English meaning of what it is. We can get the closest word, but represents. Right. Yeah. And the other interesting thing about this etymologically is that the word we've discussed earlier, jhana, has twofold meaning. One is a meaning of like sort of a psychological meaning of stillness or absorption. But the other is also an applied meaning of it means to fire, it means to burn. And it's used, and samadhi, I discovered when I was doing this, also has these two meanings. And so there's one of the other senses of samadhi is also to burn, in the sense of the mind to be, for the mind to become bright and to become illuminated. Because I think the word jhana, we use the word jhana in Buddhism a lot. And one of the interesting things is that it doesn't seem to be used in that sense consistently or very prominently in any pre-Buddhist text. So the history of Buddha is a bit obscure. It's found through the Vedas and the Upanishads, but not like consistently in the same sense as used in Buddhism. And I suspect actually that the root source, or the main root source of the word jhana in Buddhism, is taken from the Gayatri mantra. And then he in there, I think, is the ultimate source of jhana. But this is very speculative. I haven't been able to really prove it, but I think. And that sense of like the glory of the rising sun, and so that idea of awakening as being like the rising sun. And if you've ever meditated, and when your mind becomes very peaceful, it's actually a lot like that. And you're meditating and it's dark, and this light comes into your mind, and you're like, open your eyes and think, who's this voice? It really does appear like that in your mind, and it feels like the sun has come up, and your mind is full of joy and light. Yes, thank you.
In that sense, I appreciate your use of the word immersion. In the struggle to find a better English word than just concentration. One thing, looking at it now again, could it be that energy refers to the energy required, which is also required to have the memory, which is another English word for something. But then when we go on to mindfulness, it brings in the present context that, like Adam's Meadow would say, has to do with in this moment, in this context. But the context includes past, present, and future. So it broadens the bhavana bit some more. And I wonder then whether immersion is from sati to sati sampan to sati sampan jhana. Because the jhana bit or the absorption bit that brings the light you just got about.
Okay, different words, income.
Right.
Sampan jhana is a different word from jhana. Yeah, it sounds a bit similar, completely different word.
But it's sampan jhana, the jhana.
Sampan jhana.
Is a wise discernment. So that brings in the light of the wisdom, isn't it?
Sure, yeah.
But that requires us to be immersed in it in deep meditation, as you just said.
That's one aspect or one dimension of it, although sampajanya is used more generally. It's also used, for example, to describe lying. Right? So sampajanya musavada is a deliberate lie.
Oh, you really shot me to bits. You read sampajanya
against
about lying.
Right, in the vineyard, the monks rule against lying. In the five precepts, it just says musavada, false speech. But in the monks rules, it's more specific. It says sampajanya musavada. Right, so lying while being fully aware of it, lying while understanding the fact that you're lying.
Right.
Yeah.
To discern when we are lying.
Exactly, rather than just saying something false by mistake or whatever.
Yeah, again, that discernment comes from that immersion.
But it relates to it, but I wouldn't say it comes from it. It's more broad. So the discernment, sampajanya is usually treated primarily as one of those factors which leads up to samadhi. Uh-huh. Yeah. So Pali has a lot of words for wisdom which tend to overlap in meaning. But sampajanya tends to be used more for that preliminary kind of wisdom, the kind of situational awareness and so on. Whereas words say jnana or panya Anya and various others are used more for that kind of realization after immersion.
So we could have a discourse from you one day, the layers of wisdom.
Oh, absolutely.
So if I'm helping the kind of worms, can we just have some still flowing water at the moment in the limitations of words and get them on?
We can. In one moment, I think you have another question.
Yes, because you just mentioned that Dharma, this word, does not appear often in other like religions.
I was just saying it doesn't appear clearly in that same sense.
Yeah.
So it's not exactly clear how the Buddhist usage of jhana was derived from the early usage.
Yeah. So do you consider that the meaning of jhana maybe covers something that does not appear in other religions?
I don't think you can infer from particular word usages to like the realities of what the words are describing so much. I think the main difference, the main innovation that the Buddha brought in this particular area was to speak about states of meditation in a much more clearly defined psychological terms. Whereas in the Upanishads and the earlier literature, they speak about meditation in much more evocative and religious terms. And so that ability to talk about something, you know, you have an experience in meditation, you say, oh, it's so amazing, I was lifted out of myself, I felt like I've become one with the universe. And so you can use this kind of language, and it's very kind of emotional, and it's very evocative, and it's very powerful and inspiring language. But the Buddha was kind of a killjoy. And he'd say, well, okay, you became one with the universe, but what's actually going on? Huh? And he'd say, well, you know, you can experience these kinds of mental qualities that were happening. You know, you had that feeling of pleasure. Ah, okay, so there's one mental quality. And you had that mindfulness that was going on, so it's another mental quality. So he looked at what the different psychological principles that were underlying those mystical experiences. So that difference, I think, is mainly a difference in philosophical approach and the use of language. And we should be cautious about making inferences as to what the actual underlying practices were. One of the, which actually just sort of segues into the other interesting detail about this, of course, when we read this passage, faith, energy, mindfulness, immersion, and wisdom, you of course recognize that in Buddhism we call these. Thank you. Five indriyas. Very good.
Five what, sorry?
Indriyas, spiritual faculties. Right? You all knew that, huh? Yes. A few. It's so depressing. Yes, please come back and teach us again. And I'm like, I was teaching you for 10 years and you can't remember these basic things. Anyway, alright. Okay, so five faculties. And it's kind of when you think so what the text. And remember, this text is found all schools of Buddhism, it's a foundational text. This text is clearly stating that these things were present and practiced by these traditions before the Buddha. Yeah? And it includes mindfulness. Right? So if anyone tells you mindfulness was just a Buddhist practice, well, no, there it is. Yeah? And even in the teachings when the Buddha described his practice among the Jains, he also mentions mindfulness in that context. So samadhi, also there. Wisdom, also there. So these things were, the Buddha himself was saying these things were all there in those previous traditions, like the Upanishadic tradition. Now it doesn't mean to say that they meant exactly the same thing, right? And the Buddha was quite used to taking terms and ideas from the tradition around him and then redefining them, okay? But obviously, it didn't mean something that was so completely different, right? It's a similar kind of thing, but in the Buddhism, it might be interpreted in slightly different ways. But the basic ideas of these things were clearly present before the Buddha. Jackie, do you have a question?
Yeah, it's kind of, I'm wondering earlier as well, whether how long those ideas can be traced back. Like, is there a starting point that you can see, or it's just kind of...
You have to look at the Upanishads usually, like the oldest Upanishad, Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, is probably roughly 200 years before the Buddha, thereabouts. But it also is a compilation. The two oldest Upanishads, Chandogya and Brihadaranyaka, are large texts which are compilations of many smaller texts. So the period of composition was probably quite long. I'm not sure that you find these things explicitly mentioned in this way in those texts. I haven't researched it, but I wouldn't. But you certainly find similar kinds of things. And in the Yoga Sutra, which came a bit later, then I'm pretty sure there's in the Yoga Sutra and a lot of other Buddhist ideas in there as well. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of back and forth.
Yeah.
Okay. Very good. Any other questions? So then Bodhisattva practices that realize that make checks it. Another interesting detail is the humility of Alaraka Lama. Right? He's a genuine spiritual master. Right? His student comes along and says, "Oh, I've got the same thing as you do." He doesn't say, "You know, I'm the big teacher, you know, you're just a student, I'm better than you." Fantastic, right? Please come. You know, we'll need to come together. I mean, an incredible display of humility and wisdom. That surfaces from the Buddhist tradition, that they've always regarded this, and this is why when the Buddha became enlightened, his first thought was to share his teaching with Kalama and Buddha Kalama Putta. They clearly were a very highly acclaimed teachers. Then he concluded that this teaching doesn't lead to enlightenment, only leads to rebirth in the dimension of nothingness. Important to notice this particular phrase, yava deva, only as far up as up to, that deva there is, incorrect here, it is yava / the, it's just a joining word there, and eva is the particle of the answer. Yava deva means only as far as, or just as far as. Akinchaya Yatana Upapatiya is the rebirth. Upapati means rebirth in the realm of the dimension of nothingness. Okay. Realizing this teaching was inadequate, I got disillusioned and left. Analankaritva. Inadequate. So, finally, Venerable, we come back to your question. Remember, everybody. Okay, this is all an answer to Venerable's question. Okay, so I haven't forgotten, I hope you haven't either, that when the problem is sometimes raised that the Buddha elsewhere said he practiced jhanas as a child and didn't naturally fell into jhanas. Later on, when he went forth, he went and practiced these deep samadhi states with these teachers. So why didn't he just sort of develop the samadhi further? What was the difference between the two? Later on, when he was contemplating his path, he recollected that experience of jhana as a child and said, "Oh, that's the path to awakening." Okay? Why didn't he recollect that state that he experienced under the Brahmanical teachers? Right? And so this is a problem in the interpretation. And the texts don't explain that problem. Right? They just have these different passages, and they leave it for us to interpret. So any explanation is going to be a matter of interpretation. But my understanding of this is that we have to take it in context. Right? We look at this particular context of what exactly has been going on here. Right? He has gone to these teachers. He has learned the theory. Presumably the Upanishadic theory, and presumably some variation on realizing the high Atman, right? Realizing that this little Atman is the same as the cosmic Brahman, or something like that. We're not sure exactly how it's based, but it was probably something like that. And then he practiced And that was the Lama Kalama teaching, that when you practice this attainment, then you'll become one with that great cosmic Brahma. Right? But that's not what the Buddha was looking for. He was looking for an escape from old age and death. That's what the Sutra has already told us from the beginning. So this is why he said this teaching is not enough. It doesn't lead me to the ending of rebirth. And so to me, that's the crucial difference. That in this practice with these teachers, the practice of meditation is wrapped up in a theory. Right? It's wrapped up in metaphysics. Right? You accept the metaphysics, you practice, and you get in accordance with that. And so he didn't see or didn't understand at that point actually how that worked in terms of just the nature of the mind. When he had a meditation attainment as a child, there was no metaphysics. He just sat and became peaceful. And so to me, that's the crucial difference, to understand that these things don't come from these metaphysical theories and assumptions, they just come from the nature of the mind. So this is how I see the difference between those two passages. Now, finally, to answer your question. Okay, very good. Yeah, please.
It doesn't say jhana here, so is that the attainment of the dimension of nothingness, is it jhana?
Well, it's just a matter of terminology, right? So normally in the suttas, the four higher arupa states are not referred to as jhanas. I don't know if there's a particular reason for that, or whether it's just convention, but that's the case. In the later traditions, they refer to them as jhanas, but in the suttas, they don't. Yeah. I mean, they all fall within the umbrella of samadhi, and within that umbrella of samadhi, the four jhanas are the most important part, and the four arupa states are also sometimes mentioned, four brahma viharas, and various other things are sometimes mentioned as well. Yeah.
All these teachings that have been written aren't really Buddha anyway, because it's written, so someone has written 400 years on hearsay, right?
Well, hearsay, schmearsay, they wrote it from the oral tradition. They weren't just like vaguely hearing, oh, somebody said something like this, right?
No. So, is a point to the Bible?
Sure, of course.
So, if you wanted to look up something specific to guide you, like, say, for example, in life, an issue, is there a search that you can look up? Or
yeah.
You have to read through everyone and find them and
bookmark them? Yeah, it's a good question. And it's one of the things which is a little bit difficult to... it's one of the hard problems for us to solve as people who work with this. We want to try to make these things available for people, and we want to be able to do exactly what you just talked about. And of course, within that vast ocean of scriptures, then there are many things which are great advice for many people. Now, yes, you can search, but of course search is a bit difficult because often you might be searching for an idea rather than a word. So search is one of your friends. Another one is just to read all the suttas. Yeah, never mind. What else have you got to do with your life? Okay, so that's fine. But we also have a forum. Okay, so if I had a specific question, if I couldn't find what I was looking for through search or something, another one that you can do actually is you can go down here to the indexes. And in the indexes, we have an index of subjects. Yeah? So you can look through the index of subjects for the subject that you're looking for. So it might be children, generosity, and so on. And so yep. That might help. So we've got a few things there that can help people. And if that doesn't work, then you can come over to our forum and just ask a question on there. And somebody will probably come and help you out pretty quickly. Yeah. So that's...
It might be a problem. It might be like how this person feel about, like, women, power of women.
Absolutely, yeah. Like yep. And let's see what happens here for you before we move on. Okay. Yeah. 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 Women, you want to go off? Okay, the thought, women can't attain awakening is not to be believed. Okay, so that's a good one. So let's look what that says. It's in Utah, and so you can just click on this down here. And that will take you to the tip of the text with a bit of luck. Again, remember, we just launched this the other day, so. And Wi-Fi seems to be a bit erratic here, but anyway, that's.
So you were mentioning before, like, there was these texts before, and then they kind of changed it. Did you say something like, because I know that nuns were accepted disciples before,
that's right,
and then all of a sudden they were subservient. Is
that right? I don't know about all of a sudden, but yeah, something like that.
Yeah. So would there be some saying that nuns can be disciples and others saying that they can't?
Within the early texts, no. Within the early texts, they are consistent on that, that they can be accepted. But so that's more of a case of later development.
So there could be sort of stuff within the text that are kind of not in total alignment with each other. Because there's a before and after.
Sure. You can get those kinds of things, and that's of course one of the one of the jobs of interpretation to look at it, and sometimes things can appear contradictory. But it's just an appearance. So if you look at the people wisdom, you can see maybe it's a different context and so on. Or in some cases, there might be a genuine contradiction. And then we have to look at the numbers to try to understand why that might come. It might come from a just a mistake in the text. It might come from something that was put in later. And so on. So this is what we try to understand. So this is that particular thing. So you asked a question about women in the suttas. We looked at the index. We found the entry there. We clicked on the entry and we came to this particular sutta. And the sutta has the English and the Pali. Who wants to read the English? A different volunteer this time. Come on, somebody.
At Sabati, then the nun Soma robed up in the morning, and taking her bowl and robe, entered Sabati for alms. She wandered for alms in Sabati. After the meal, on her return from the alms round, she went to the blind man's wood, plunged deep into it, and sat at the root of a tree for the day's meditation. Then Mara the wicked, wanting to make the nun Soma feel fear, terror, and goosebumps, wanting to make her fall away from immersion, went up to her and addressed her in verse. That state is very challenging. It's for the sages to attain. It is impossible for a woman with her two-fingered wisdom. Then the nun Soma thought, who's speaking this verse? A human or a non-human? Then she thought, this is Mara the wicked, wanting to make me feel fear, terror, and goosebumps, wanting to make me fall away from immersion. Then Soma, knowing that this was Mara the wicked, replied to him in verse, is Mara a man? What difference does womanhood make when the mind is serene and knowledge is present, as you rightly discern the Dhamma? Surely someone who might think, I am a woman, or I am a man, or I am anything at all, is fit for Mara to address. Then Mara the wicked, thinking, the nun Soma knows me, miserable and sad, vanished for a
So the particular phrasing that I chose there, I am woman, used as that's a bit of a little homage there to Helen Reddy. Me and my friend John, who we were musicians together, we used to break into the women's music night in Fremantle in the old days and sing I Am Woman, Hear Me Roar. What
those verses in
blank
verse in the original?
No, they all have a they're all metrical.
They do not rhyme.
There's various kinds of sort of playfulness and like alliteration and all kinds of things, but they don't use sort of a strict rhyming pattern. They do the Indian verses aren't so strong. It's essentially metrical. But doing a metrical translation is hard, so I didn't do it.
Do you think in this context, Ma is actually some kind of being, or just like
doubting
her own name?
Well, I think that my personal reading would be that these are, these are stories. You know? So, you know, both of those alternatives are, in a sense, kind of realist alternatives. Either Mara is a real deity who went to and spoke to her, or it's a purely psychological event. But I, you know, as you know, I've been very interested in mythology and storytelling. And so I look at it as saying, well, this is a way of giving a teaching by framing it within a storytelling idiom. So I don't necessarily think it has to be reduced. I think it can. Could you say that these kinds of events could come from either of those things? Sure, they could come from either of those things. But the form in which we perceive them is the form of the story. And of course, this chapter is full of stories of the nuns having similar kinds of encounters with Mara. So it's a way of framing a certain style of teaching, and that had a certain, why this particular style of teaching was framed for nuns and so on. I think it's interesting, but I'm not exactly sure why. By the way, the blind man's wood up here, I've actually changed it. This should be Mirkwood, is my new translation of this underline. Mm. I think that got lost on the way from the anyway, sorry.
Wisdom doesn't have a gender. So what is this two-fingered wisdom?
Ah, thank you, yes. Dwanduri Panyaya. Well, this is of course Mara's words, and you say that wisdom isn't gendered as if this is uncontroversial. whereas humanity at large would probably tend to differ. And the idea that the women's wisdom is inferior is not at all uncommon. What the exact idiom means is a bit hard to say. I think the commentary explains it in terms of that they would test whether the rice had been cooked with using two fingers to press on it, something like that. That doesn't sound. I think what it means is that, like, because wisdom is you grasp things, right? With a strong man, you grasp. With women, the name is a relief. I think that's what it means.
This is what you meant. Oh,
British.
The wisdom is just too thick for a man's hand.
Yes, oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
It's true. A few paling short of the fence or something.
Something like that, yeah. Exactly. We should have translated it that way. You Sheila's a few shrimps short of the barber. you could translate that. It might be a little bit too close here.
You could just make an Australian translation version. Just for Oz.
I was thinking by saying with two fingers, you know, you hold your hand up with four fingers, and that's how they used to measure height.
Okay.
You know, for instance, horses, they also call me hands high, and they have 4 inches. So two fingers is, you know,
it's half
the amount.
Yeah, half the measure. Yeah. Could be another one. Yeah. And squeeze it, yeah. Right, so it's how you know it's cooked or not. Exactly, yeah. Now, that's fine, I think that's the commentary explanation, yeah. So the two-finger wisdom is the wisdom of, it's merely domestic wisdom, right?
Mm.
Yeah. All it means is like, you know, knowing how to feed people and keep families alive. It's not like it's anything important.
Yeah. that I think, you know, I think the both of us could be.
Seems to be coming back to the word Mara, because in some Indian tradition, each name has a significant meaning. So
right.
Mara means to kill.
Right.
To claim, to kill.
Of kill.
So does that
sure, yeah. Yeah, Mara is associated with death and delusion in Pali. Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
Does Mara mean lesion of the mind, or what?
Sorry?
Does Mara really mean, is the person a lesion of the mind, or?
Well, tradition says that there are five kinds of Mara. There's Mara who's a Devaputta, Mara who's a delusion of the mind, Mara who's death, Mara is the five aggregates. I think there's another one for me. So it's used in different ways, in different kind of narrative context, and in different kind of sense.
Sorry?
For sure, yeah. Yeah. So I mean, there are certain passages where Mara in suttas is clearly depicted as being psychological forces, right? I mean, that's not like an interpretation, you know, like the ten armies of Mara in Suttanipata, you know, sloth is one, and sense desire is another, and anger is another, and so on. So it's clearly saying that these are used in a metaphorical sense. But then there are other passages where I think that there's a Devaputta. I mean, the thing to remember that in Buddhist cosmology, that rebirth is determined by the mind. So if there are these states in the mind, then there will be beings who are born who correspond to those states. Right? That's the basic Buddhist cosmology. And so Mara, you know, I mean, I think personally I take Mara in these kinds of great cases as being mainly, like I said, mainly like used as a narrative convention in order to kind of illustrate various points of Dharma. It's a way of dramatizing things, no?
But it's also in literate times, you can tell a story and paint a picture literally on the wall.
Exactly.
For others to learn right. Through visualization.
Absolutely, and that became such a powerful part of
Buddhist tradition. Church, isn't it, right?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And you see, like the Buddhist traditions, the pictures of Mara were, you know, Mara's eyes
yeah.
attacking the Buddha
yeah,
and so on.
Yeah,
so...
I think the transgenic in the mind is trying to get into a system, more like this.
Find an entrance.
Yeah.
Mm. Okay?
May I?
Please.
Sometimes in meditation, what might come up like that memory is what somebody said. So if you have cultural prejudices, it will arise in the mind as the thought that somebody said. If one hears
oh,
it,
yeah. Yeah.
And so it's a past karma, you know, and the culture. So if there was belief that women were inferior, one may hear it, you know, it will arise, one hears it as something external to oneself, and one recognizes, ah, this is coming just from the culture. This is
yeah.
not ah, this is not me, this
yeah.
is not myself.
Yeah. Culturally, even past lives, or. Okay, so what I'd like to do is for this, well, one of the things that I did in the process of, as I think I mentioned, was I made a bunch of essays on different topics. And in the slideshow which I showed you earlier, I discussed a few issues in translation which had actually come from these essays. And so this is the list of the whole list of essays, about 130 of them. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to get you guys to choose a topic that looks interesting that we could discuss a little bit. And so I'm going to go to the bottom of this list, right? And I'm going to scroll up a little bit, and you can tell me which topic sounds interesting, right? And then we can discuss that. But if you choose wrongly, then I'll say no. Because it might sound interesting because I've got a cool title on it, but it might actually be a boring article. So you choose one that you think that sounds like an interesting discussion, okay?
There's one about an elephant and women I saw quickly. We've just been talking about women, so there's
okay.
Nothing to do with an elephant and women.
An elephant and women, okay?
Our material possessions are popularity,
That's a bit boring. It's just a translation of that particular phrase, which I sort of changed a little bit of the nuance. Yeah, sorry. Unknowability of samsara and grace and peace.
Yes, yeah.
Okay, that's it. Let's see what we got here. Okay, so I have to scroll back up to the top. Okay, drums and peg. Oh yeah, this was kind of fun one. So this one relates to a particular sutta, Sanyutta Nikaya number 20.7, which I think we do a translation for. So look at the sutta. Sanyutta Nikaya 20.7. So it is suttas, linked discourses of Sanyutta Nikaya. And remember in the Diga Nikaya, we have the long and the miscellaneous ones. They do have a similar thing with Sanyutta Nikaya, the Pali Sanyutta Nikaya, Chinese Sanyutta Dagama. But we have the first, second, and third Sanyutta Dagama in Chinese. And these are incomplete collections. So one complete Sanyutta Dagama, and these are two partial ones, and then various other miscellaneous ones. Oops, wrong one, two pages here. And that was 20.7. So the 20, so let's go back here. The number 20 here, SN, is Sanyutta Nikaya, 20. Is the number that will appear close to 10, I was talking about saying that it's kind of 10 in China. Is that number here. So when you see the reference, 20.7, this is the 20, right? So it's the Okama Sanyutta, the collection on similes, and 20.7, I believe it was, the drum peg. Okay, so here we have the particular discourse. So this is the one that we're talking about. It's only a short one, so why don't we read it? Somebody want to read this one? Because I know you all like doing that. Yeah, please. Yeah.
I might need to come down a bit closer.
Please do, yeah, if you are like and big enough.
Savati, once upon a time, mendicants, the Dasaharas, had a clay drum called the Commander. Each time the Commander split, they repaired it by inserting another peg. But there came a time when the clay drum, Commander's original wooden rim, disappeared, and only a mass of pegs remained. In the same way, in a future time, there will be
mendicants,
who won't want to listen.
Sorry, I'm just going to map that down and check out quickly. Sorry, please continue.
In the same way, in a future time, there will be a mendicant who won't want to listen.
Mendicants, it should be plural.
In the same way, in a future time, there will be mendicants who won't want to listen when discourses spoken by the realized one, deep, profound, transcendent, dealing with emptiness, are being recited. They won't pay attention or apply their minds to understand them, nor will they think those teachings are worth learning and memorizing. But when discourses composed by poetry, with fancy words and phrases, composed by outsiders or spoken by disciples, are being recited, they will want to listen. They'll pay attention and apply their minds to understand them, and they'll think that those teachings are worth learning and memorizing. And that is how the discourses spoken by the realized one, deep, profound, transcendent, dealing with emptiness, will disappear. So you should train like this. When discourses spoken by the realized one, deep, profound, transcendent, dealing with emptiness, are being recited, we will want to listen. We will pay attention and apply our minds to understand them. And we will think those teachings are worth learning and memorizing. That's how we should train.
It's basically to keep the audience's attention and make them pay.
So the simile of the clay drum is used here, and it's an interesting one because it's used in other terms which are only found in this particular context, and so the interpretation is a little bit unclear. So most of these essays I wrote to sort of discuss various issues about how to interpret these things. So this particular essay, summary of things. So the commentary to the text has a long and fun background story involving a huge crab and a mountain troll. But I will leave that aside. I like teasing people. It was actually a fun story. But anyway, so Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. The Saharas had a kettle drum called the Samana. When the Samana became cracked, the Saharas inserted another peg. Eventually the time came when the Samana's original drum head had disappeared and only collected the pegs remained. Okay, so a number of interesting sort of problems with the translation. Who were the Dasaharas? Why did they have a drum? Right? If the drum was just a ceremonial or musical instrument, why is it so remembered and how are we to explain the name? But the Dasaharas is not mentioned anywhere else. The same name is found in a Yudhagama text. A literal translation is the ten takers, Dasaharas. Yeah? Commentary has explained this as they took 10%. Right? The Dasaharas. One of the primal innovations of the Indo-European peoples was the taming of horses and the invention of the fast two-wheel chariot. With advanced military technology, they burst out of their homeland and spread from Ireland to Sri Lanka. At least part of their cultural heritage was a memory of time as nomadic raiders. It's been argued that this was the ultimate root of the term Bharata, i.e. booty, but it's carried off in a raid. I think this suggests a theory for the Dasaharas. They were a tribe of nomadic raiders, whether historical or an artifact of cultural history. They showed up outside pastoral villages and demanded 10% of their crops, or whatever other bounties they possessed. They announced their presence by beating a loud drum. Okay? Sources emphasize how loud the drum was. The Pali commentary says it could be heard for 12 leagues, while the Chinese text says 40. So the name of the drum, the commander, that sort of gives some explanation of why these people were named after their drum, right? They got this big, intimidating drum, which would be terrifying to hear. And if you're in the village, you hear this doom, doom, doom. The commander, right? Oh, yeah, okay, we just lost 10% of everything, right? They're going to take 10%. And that's, you know, it's not an unrealistic portrayal, you know, of raiders and things like that. Often raiders in villages, they wouldn't just come in and destroy the village and so on, because that's where they get their stuff from, you know? So they're much happier to just collect 10%. The villagers, you know, are okay, they take 10%, and then they can come back next year and get another 10%. So that's, I mean, that's speculative, but that's what I suspect that the basic situation is. So what kind of drum is it? Mudinga. Kettle drum, according to Venerable Bodhi, Tanisara, a large drum. But they're actually, mridanga is a common form of Indian drum today. Anyone here, do you know any music? Okay, yeah.
Even in Sri Lanka.
Mm.
They have
the same one? Yeah. Okay, and what do they call it in Sri Lanka? That's also similar to another name, another word for drums in Pali. But I mean, I think in India today.
Okay,
there you go. In Bengali. So I mean, in India there's so many drums, right? There's so many different ones and so many different kinds of drums. And I'm sure the same thing was the case there. So it's not necessarily exactly the same kind of drum. Probably it would have been a loud, commanding one. Yeah.
Now when Buddha talks about the beating the drum as his
destiny,
what kind of thing does he use?
So this is another word for drum. There's probably half a dozen words for drums in Pali. Now that one is Amata Dundubi. So that word for drum is Dundubi. So you can figure out what kind of drum it was just by hearing the word. Dundubi. Exactly. Yeah. Mridinga. Mridinga is probably similar, right? Mridinga. Okay, so here we have. Oh, it's cool. Oh, I put a video on it. Alright. So what is this kind of drum? Wi-Fi seems to be a bit slow, so I'm not sure if we're going to get anything. Looks like we're going to be disappointed here. Anyway, I might just leave it for now. We'll see if it comes up. So I've did a little bit of research into the Mudinga, and none of them noted that the Pali text, they had various sources for where this word had come from, but none of them noted that it's actually found in the Pali, which was much earlier than any of the attested sources that I saw in the articles about this. Most likely it's from the word mrida, meaning earth or clay. So it's probably some kind of clay drum, perhaps related to the kus of the ancient Persians, used in the same way, also a clay drum. Oh, here we go. We've got some. Oh, so this is a mrida. Most of you are probably more familiar with this sound.
Is there a link between the sutta and the essay? That when you're reading the sutta, does it tell you that there's a discussion about it?
Is there a direct link between this and this and that? Not as much as there should be. Yeah. There is the other way around, but
Right.
That's a that's in the pipeline. Okay, so next one is about the pigs, right? So the Pali word for the name of the drum is Arnika, with the third word, probably not important. So Bhikkhubodhi translates it as drum head. Now, how do you replace a drum? Like a drum head is the whole pit at the top of the drum, including the skin and so on. How do you replace that with a collection of pigs? So that doesn't sound very likely. But the Pali is Bokhara Palaka, where Bokhara means lotus, and it's a term for the lotus like skin of a drum. Palaka means a plank or piece of wood. The Pokhara Palaka must be the rim, i.e., a circlet of wood holding the skin in place. These days, most Indian drum skins are held in place with rims that use complex ties that you can tune it with. So you can see here the skin of the drum, a bit like a lotus leaf, and then the rim which holds it in place. But and so this, you know, modern Indian drums, of course, are very sophisticated, right? And they can be tuned very, very finely, and the tone of them is adjusted very finely, and they have to be constantly very carefully adjusted for like the climate and all of these kinds of things. So it's actually a lot of work it's a very skilled task just to prepare a modern Indian drum for a concert, right? To get all those things right. But in the old days, it was probably a bit simpler. This is one from Africa. I couldn't find an Indian example like this, but this is, I think, perhaps a similar one from Africa. And so here, I believe this is clay. Right, so I think what it's talking about is that you have the body of it would be clay, and then around the rim, you'd have a wooden rim, and then the drum head is pegged into the wooden rim around the top. For this one, the drum head is split. But so I think the idea was that as time goes on and the wooden rim sort of gradually disappears because more and more pegs had to be put into it because the rim itself was disintegrating. So I think that hopefully a little bit closer to understanding exactly what kind of thing that they were talking about.
I'm not sure if I follow the simile clearly. Does it mean that part of the drama here takes place the wooden ring. And so when that's gone, the piece collapses.
Something like that, yeah. So each part is disintegrating, and so they keep on repairing it by putting in more pigs, and eventually it's just pigs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Does it mean that the membrane then breaks off and it's
something like that, yeah, and then the sound is not pure and beautiful anymore.
In this equivalent, to me, like to try and NAGDA, Nagada is called.
Nagada?
Nagada, yeah. It's like not at all, but
yeah.
Like broader.
Okay.
You know?
Nagada, similar to this one.
This is long, this is vertical, that's a bit horizontal, but you know, you would see this with a stick.
Oh, okay. So it's got a lot of fun that you did with the stick rather than seeing.
NAGDA.
NAGDA. Okay, I'll look it up. Yeah, thank you. Okay, so drums and pigs, please, yes.
Now, one question about the previous sutra, Noble Sutra.
All right,
if you want to find out more about dimension of nothingness, what do you do?
So you can just search for it on the Sutta Central?
That's probably an essay on that.
Yeah, yeah. You can search for it on the Sutta Central, you can search for it on the forum. Or you could just ask on the forum if you have a specific question there. Forum's pretty good, actually. People are pretty active and ask questions and helping out with things. I'm usually on there most days if I get the chance. Okay, so drums and pigs. Okay, so that's what I said. And then the other one people asked one was on the unknowability of samsara. Now, I just want to point out to you, everybody, that there was 130 essays, and we only showed you about 10 of them, and you already selected two, so, you know, bit of restraint, right? Anyway, okay, so I can't remember what's in half of these essays, so it's a discovery for me. So in Sanyutta Nikaya 15.1 and elsewhere, we have a striking assertion that for the first point that samsara is unknowable. So as we did before, we can go and just check out the sutra itself. So SN 15.1 and just let people know this is something that's people ask about how it's searched. If you know the ID for a sutta, you can just write it in the URL. You don't have to go searching for it or anything like that. That's actually the fastest way to get it. So mendicants, transmigration has no known beginning. No first point is found with sentient beings roaming and transmigrating, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. Suppose a person was to strip all the grass, sticks, branches and leaves in India, gather them together in one pile and chop them into 4-inch pieces. They lay them down saying, this is my mother, this is my grandmother. The grass, sticks, branches and leaves of India would run out before that person's mothers and grandmothers. Why is that? Transmigration has no known beginning. No first point is found of sentient beings roaming and transmigrating, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. For such a long time you have undergone suffering, agony and disaster swelling the cemeteries. This is quite enough for you to become disillusioned, dispassionate and freed from all conditions. Okay, so nobody was as good as the Buddha when it came to similes. Okay. Just when you thought he'd given the most amazing simile you could think of, he suddenly comes up with a better one. And you know, we can think about that in the whole vast subcontinent of India. And in those days, of course, there were a lot more trees and so on than there are today, right? So all of those jungles were there. Can you imagine how you could take them and just put them into little bits like that? My mother's and grandmother's is more than that. My goodness. Many times have I been disobedient to all of those mothers and grandmothers? So this is the similar. And so the particular phrase of transmigration or samsara has no known beginning. No first point is found. This is found in many suttas. So this is really just the first one in the collection. So I'm quoting from this, but actually that stock phrase is found in many suttas with different similes and different applications. So that's a bit of a discussion here. Philosophically, this idea is crucial as it introduces the acceptance of unknowability into the Buddha's teaching. Right? Unknowability. The first point of samsara is unknowable. As no known beginning. This is a fascinating and subtle point compared with the foundations in modern science and mathematics, such as Gödel's theorems or the uncertainty principle in quantum theory. Anyone want to explain Gödel's theorems? Go on.
The incompleteness theorem.
Yeah.
You should maybe use
the Holden problem.
Yeah.
Yeah? Alan Turing's Holden problem is another example.
Yeah, in quantum, if the states aren't orthogonal, it's actually proven that it's unknowable.
Right.
You can't compare, you can't discriminate.
Right.
But that's more in the. So that's a variant of what you've got there.
Yeah.
Which is probably relevant. Inherent knowledge of quantum world is a knowability.
Right.
As a side. Yeah, that's in the. I got the name of it.
So in this has been a critical shift, probably the definitive shift in Western philosophy and Western science around the mid 20th century. That up until that time, there was a much more kind of optimistic outlook with regards to knowledge and the idea that we could find a final knowledge and explanation and understanding of things. And 19th century physicists were basically like, you know, we've pretty much got all this kind of stuff sorted out. There's just a couple of issues with gravity and light we have to figure out. But, you know, pretty much, you know, we've got it down. And what's his name? I can't remember his name. I wrote Theologica, The Principia Mathematica. Russell? Was it Russell? Western philosopher, early 20th century. And that basically tried to do a kind of definitive treaties that would sort of lay out the principles and foundations for knowledge once and for all. And they really believed that you could do this. And then a series of thinkers came up. Gödel was an important one. Alan Turing applied this in computer science and came up with what he called the Holden problem, which basically is the idea that there's always something that computers can't decide. In Wittgenstein, the great philosopher, said that of which we cannot speak, we must remain silent. Right? Again, saying that there are limits to what we can know and limits to what we can talk about. And so, and this was found and expressed in many different ways throughout Western philosophy and science, especially in the mid 20th century. And the crucial thing is that's not a failure. Right? And of course, and obviously quantum theory being another important one, that's not a failure. Once you accept that, it opens the doorway to actual real knowledge, right? So Alan Turing's Holden problem with computer science wasn't a failure of computer science, it was what enabled us to actually establish computing science. Once you accept the limits on the knowability, then you start to explore what you can actually do. Mm-hmm. Right? And this is a principle of Indian philosophy also, again, not an innovation. Buddha, found in the famous Nasadiya Sutta of the Rig Veda, whence all creation, he, whether he fashioned it or whether he did not, he who surveys it all from the highest heaven, he knows, or maybe even he does not know.
So,
huh?
Information entropy, look at that for the knowability.
Right.
So if I've got a superposition of apple and orange, and you've got a superposition of apple and orange, you can never distinguish the two.
And that unknowability in quantum theory is precisely what makes quantum computers, at least in principle, so powerful, because they can have that ambiguity. So whence all creation had its origin, he, talking about God here, he, whether he fashioned it or whether he did not, he who surveys it all from the highest heaven, he knows, or maybe even he doesn't know. Right? I mean, can you imagine something like that in the Bible? Huh? Huh? God knows all. Maybe. Not. Yeah. And so that kind of acceptance of the limitations of knowledge, right, is found in the Indian tradition. Like they're questioning about who knows these things, how much do they know, and the Buddha inherited them. Despite such wisdom, ancient, even the Buddha day, philosophers in the time of the Buddha still sought to know the answer to questions of whether the universe was finite or infinite, questions that the Buddha repeatedly dismissed. So in this case, the philosophical position is clear and well established.
What is unclear is the exact meaning of the phrase anamataka. Most likely represents a double negative, na mata aga, not known beginning. Thank you. But it's susceptible to various interpretations, and the Sanskritic font is somewhat differently. The Pali Text Society dictionary comments that the meaning is best not seen from etymology but the context. The century of Buddhist studies has not changed that. Vikkhu Bodhi renders mata here as discoverable, but I'm not sure that this doesn't overinterpret the phrase just a little. Technically, as a past participle, it means unknown, and it doesn't explicitly mean that it can't be known. Perhaps, though, this is justifiable in context. It seems from the Sanskritic forms in the Tibetan translations that it came to be understood in the sense of without beginning or end. This is, of course, a distinctly different philosophical position. And it's hardly a surprise to say that later schools of Buddhism tried to gloss over the fact that even the Buddha had limits to his knowledge. Right? So the early texts are saying that the beginnings of samsara are unknown or unknowable, whereas the later tradition tended to say that it was without being beginning or end. The Buddha's sophisticated acknowledgement of epistemological limits has been replaced with a metaphysical ontology, which is exactly what he was trying to avoid. So the Pali commentaries don't do that. They say the beginning is unknown and unrealized even after pursuing it with knowledge for 100 or 1,000 years. And then there's a discussion about the interpretation in various dictionaries, and maybe that's sort of supporting that. And I did some math at the end. Okay. As a postscript to this, in one of the discourses in the same collection, it said that if four people were to recollect 100,000 eons per day for 100 years, they could still not recollect all of samsara. And assuming that 30 billion years is an eon, so this is the estimated lifespan of the universe, that means samsara is 4.38 times 10 to the 20 years long. Which is long.
Is it just one cycle, the answer you give?
The one cycle would be, I think that would be the 30 billion years. So that would be 1 eon. And then this would be the whole. Then I mean, that's not saying it's the limit of it, but it's saying that it's even further than that.
How can you possibly have limits and stop? It doesn't make sense.
So this is that one on the unknowability of samsara. Okay, so do you want to try another one? Yeah? You want to find another interesting question? And the hills of worship in Hinduism, is that right? Relay chair? No, we've already gone past that one. It's pretty much. Which one?
It was one of the
No, it's finished late. It's finished late. You can't. We're going to start.
Yes. It's
dark.
On the ceiling of the rock and letting go of what is not.
I'll just have to back up. I really can't remember what these things are about. And I'll have to see whether it's interesting or not. That's right, yeah. It's impossible. Okay, so the question here, so the simile of the raft, of course you're all familiar with?
No.
No? All right, well, let's look at the sutta. So here is it's a fascinating text for many reasons. It tells the story of the truly monumental smackdown the Buddha delivers to Aritta the vulture trapper, who misrepresents the teachings to argue that having sex was no obstacle to spiritual practice. Okay? Now, it's quite a long sutta, so I might just read the excerpt from here. So here's the simile, famous simile of the raft. Now, suppose there was a person traveling along the road, they'd see a large deluge whose near shore is beauteous and perilous, while the far shore is a sanctuary free from peril. But there's no ferry boat or bridge for crossing over. They think, why don't I gather grass, sticks, branches and leaves and make a raft? Riding on the raft and paddling with my hands and feet, I can safely reach the far shore. And so they do exactly that. And when they crossed over to the far shore, they think, this raft was very helpful to me. Riding on the raft and paddling with my hands and feet, I have safely crossed over to the far shore. Why don't I hoist it on my head or pick it up my shoulder and go wherever I want? What do you think, mendicants? Would that person be doing what should be done with that raft? No, sir. And what, mendicants, should that person do with the raft? When they've crossed over, they'd think, this raft was very helpful to me. Why don't I beach it on dry land or set it adrift in the water and go wherever I want? That's what that person should do with the raft. In the same way, I've taught how the teaching is similar to a raft. It's for crossing over, not for holding on. By understanding the simile of the raft, you will even give up the teachings, let alone what is against the teachings. Very well-known simile, but the interpretive problem here is exactly how we translate dhamma. And in the, I've translated it here as teachings, and so here I'm explaining why I've done that. And so a lot of this, what I do in a lot of these little essays, is I look at what different translators have done, try to understand why they translated it that way, and in some cases, I come to different conclusions. So that last one, where what are we giving up? Venerable Bodhi has states, we're giving up states, mental states, I guess. Venerable Chanantra just keeps the word dhammas, so that Chalmers, the 19th century English translator, had things, giving up the things. I don't know, is that right? I always quite like thing as a translation from Dhamma. I think it's quite good. I think we should do it back in the chanting. You say, like, I bow my head to the thing. The thing is not expounded by the Buddha. Anyway, Horner has right and wrong mental optics. Maybe Horner. All these craft translations, true ideas and untrue ideas. Okay, so thus the bulk of the translators have taken Dhamma here in the sense of mental qualities or mental phenomena. This is following the commentary, which however defines it more precisely as regarding attachment to advanced meditation states of samatha and vipassana. This was contrasted to the bad example of Arita, who has referred to Adhamma in the sense of vulgar practices, i.e. sex. So basically it's saying that rather than that Arita was saying that being attached to sex was not an obstacle to spiritual practice, but the sutra is saying, well, look, even attachment to higher meditation states can be an obstacle to practice, right? Much less attachment to sex. So, but that's the commentarial interpretation. And I won't go into too much about these because it's a bit of a long essay and a bit complicated. Okay, so I've translated it as teachings earlier in the phrase sutta, that teachings is repeatedly used in the sense, sorry, dhamma in plural is repeatedly used in the sense of teachings. A person has learned the teaching, statements, songs, and so on and so forth. Given that this sense is quite straightforward, this question must arise as to why the commentaries go to such lengths to insert an unrelated meaning. The commentaries stem from a tradition that had apparently moved far from the practice of meditation in favor of preservation of the texts. Perhaps it was too controversial for them, and it's just a speculation, to say that the teachings must be let go of, and better to point out the fallacies implicit in meditation practice. There is always a tension between doctrine and experience, and the guardians of doctrinal orthodoxy always nurture a certain suspicion of meditative experience. It's not unreasonable. The plain fact is that meditators frequently misunderstand or misrepresent their experience, and a degree of skepticism tempering reports of experience with the understanding of the text is crucial. While this is understandable, it seems that here the tendency went too far, deflecting attention from the limits of textual knowledge to the limits of meditation experience. As so often, the commentarial views become embodied in the translations, and these always need to be carefully and critically examined. Hopefully this is one small step to rectifying this. Again, it's a question of interpretation, but at the end of the day, this is why I think that the means the teachings. Questions? Yeah.
There's so many different translations of the Pali terms. Like, I found that, you know, often it's quite unclear until you read, like, a large number of translations, you get every sense.
Yeah.
just sort of wondering. Also, can you show us like how to get the when you hover over polytext, the English translation? Is that only yours?
Okay, yeah. So you can do a few cool things with it. So it's so with the new translations that I've made, the segmented translations, in the future we'll be having more texts that are segmented, but at the moment they're just my translations. And so when you read it by default, you'll see it like this, and it just has the translation. And if you want to see it side by side, that's how we've been looking at it up to now. You can do it side by side. You can also view it line by line, if you prefer. Not one line of Pali with one line of English. Yep. So that's nice. That one's nice, especially if you're like on a mobile or something, you can read it that way. And you can also view it with a pop-up, so you can just look at the English and then pop up and then Pali will be there. So these are just different. Once the hard part is actually creating the segmented text and putting that all together. Once you've done it, then you can do all these cool things with it. Okay. So let's see if we can maybe just look at one more of these essays before we finish up.
Elephant
eating things. You're interested in, are you interested in either elephants or in eating? Or both. Okay, so this man seems to be that elephant eating things. Okay. There's in Majjhima Nikaya number 27. Right. Okay, so just have a quick look at Majjhima Nikaya 27. And this again, the suttas, middle discourses of Majjhima Nikaya. And here, so the number 27 will be here, 21 to 30. So we can find it here. Majjhima Nikaya 27. Buddha cautions against strict conclusions about teacher's spiritual accomplishments, comparing to the care a tracker would use when trapping elephants. Okay, so this is where the elephants come in. And so this particular discourse basically somebody sees the Buddha and his skill in debating and discussing, and then concludes that the Buddha is enlightened. And the Buddha gives a very nice kind of simile, which essentially is urging an epistemological caution, right? It's basically, and so he gives this long simile. If an elephant tracker were to enter an elephant wood, there they'd see a large elephant's footprint, long and broad. Still, the elephant tracker wouldn't yet come to the conclusion this must be a big bull elephant, because in an elephant wood there are dwarf she elephants with big footprints, and this footprint might be one of theirs. Okay? And then it goes on and talks about all these different kinds of different words for different kinds of elephants. So it might not be, because there are tall she elephants with long trunks and big footprints. There are tall and fully grown she elephants with big footprints. And so on. And then eventually they see the big bull elephant. And only when you see the big bull elephant do you finally realize that this must be a big bull elephant. So the same way with the Buddha, that you shouldn't come to premature and leap to conclusions about the Buddha based on just on hearsay or based on trivial information. And so this is one of the things that the Buddha is very distinctive of the Buddha as a spiritual teacher, that he encouraged his disciples to investigate him carefully and closely. And don't just take me at my word, investigate everything I'm saying, see whether it's true. And so this is a simile which is there to encourage that. And so in the process of it, it has a few interesting passages, interesting terms for elephants. So one of them is the word kalarika, an obscure term that has so far been interpreted as having prominent teeth. But the passage describes how elephants leave traces in the leaf tire. And I don't see how teeth figure into this. It's especially odd that the tusks are not mentioned until the next passage, but surely marks by tusks will be seen higher up than those with teeth. The Sanskrit dictionaries give a similar term, kagra, vakara, in the sense of long trunk, and surely that's what this must mean. I'm not sure how the derivation works out exactly. Presumably it's made in relation to kara in the sense of hand or trunk. Anyway, this is really just an excuse to put up some photos of elephants munching leaves. And so there you go. That's one happy looking elephant. It's nice, isn't it? You know, and again to me, this is like when you see, I mean, those of you who have been, you know, maybe brought up in countries where they have elephants, then you can see this. But for those of us in Australia, you know, to see the that come to life, you know, oh yes, there's the elephant reaching right up into the trees to grab those leaves from the tree. And this is the elephant imagine. Well, of course, since he was in New Zealand, he didn't come to that. Yeah. Well, right. Yeah. I know, right? I mean, they're very confident.
He takes up a whole car sport. So, like, you have Andrew's farm. And when I was a kid, Sri Lanka, I saw an elephant farm. And he's got a park right next, set right next to us. And the owner goes in and gets him a bottle of Coke. And puts it down. And it's terrible for his teeth. Yeah.
Really?
It's in candy. It's in candy.
You think that the caffeine might be a little bit.
And he loves it. He waits. He knows what's happening. Yeah, and I was in the car.
I don't know if you'd want to give the caffeine to an elephant. I mean, that's cool.
He only has one. And he loves an olive.
I guess so. Alright.
Like in the yogic tradition, we have like the sutra and we have like characteristics of the sutra, so Kaleshloka sutra and sutra.
Yeah.
In the Buddhist tradition, like what are the characteristics of a sutra? Like what could define them? Is there anything there in the tradition?
They have a similar thing. Actually, we have the passages like that a little while ago. That was in the community.
Like in the Buddha tradition, we have like alpha akshara, very concise word, very universal, very
accurate. Right. Yep. So, I believe. That's right. No, it's not something. There's a list of, we can count it earlier, I can't remember which letter it was, but there's a list of different styles of teaching which is found from the early times, and they're called the nine angas, or the nine parts or factors of the Dhamma. And they are, the number one is the suttas, or discourses, which is a similar meaning to the sutta in the Brahmanical, but also in the Jaina tradition. The sutra is basically initially had the meaning of like a short statement or aphorism, and then later on came to mean a discourse in general.
Like a
philosophy. Yeah, that's right. It would be like a short thing which you make a commentary upon. And sutra, gaya is verse or songs. Vyakarana in the early tradition had a different meaning. Later tradition, yes, it meant grammar, but in the early tradition it meant Q&A, question and answer. So basically it was text and dialogue form, Vyakarana, and then a group of more minor terms, Dharma and various other ones. So they did analyze it originally in terms of these kind of literary songs.
Looking at what's on the screen at the moment, it looks as if they are reciting the Dharma in the lifetime of the Buddha.
choice.
But I was only taking the Ananda and I put it all together at the end. So that's not okay.
Well, I mean, I think Ananda's role was as a organizer, but there was certainly the recycling of the Buddha. Yeah, so the recitation tradition happened during the Buddha's lifetime. And so Ananda, basically, they sort of got together and said, okay, now the Buddha's gone, we've got to get serious. And so they started to arrange the sutras in a way that would be facilitate memorizing. And we don't know much details about exactly what happened, but it seems very likely that what would have happened is that they would decide, like, assign certain texts to certain groups, like in this monastery, the auspicious, in this group, in that monastery, the auspicious, in another one, and then organize them and all of that kind of thing. So that was really the work we've done at the first council.
I think that's another reason, is that at that time people don't have books, so for the bhikkhus, if they want to practice, they have to recite it first. And
oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And again, we don't have the records, but I know monks very well, and so I'm absolutely certain that when they introduced writing books, all of the old monks would think, this young monk today. where nowadays we used to memorize it. Don't you really know it? You only really know the sutras if you memorize it. You know it by heart. Now, young monks today, they think they can just copy it on this new fangled palm leaf. What even is that? You know? And they copy it on this palm leaf and they put it away and you don't even read it, you can just keep it in the library and you don't have to know anything about it. You think you know the suttas because you've read it. Rah, that's rubbish. But seriously, I'm sure that there would have been a lot of controversy about adopting these new technologies and a lot of resistance. And in the only record we have of this is from the Mahavamsa in Sri Lanka, and they started writing. And of course, the crucial episode is that they only did that after a huge famine and after a huge war, when the whole country was devastated, and they began to face the future. A lot of people lose it altogether, and so it took that traumatic event for them to actually shift and say, "Hang on, we better do this." And another kind of indication of this is that even till today, the oral tradition is still very strong in all of the different Buddhist traditions, whether the Pali tradition, Chinese, Tibetan, Vietnamese traditions. People still memorize texts and they still recite texts a lot, so the oral tradition has never gone away. It's existed alongside the manuscript tradition.
Can I please ask you to remember the Nitra conference on Sunday, you mentioned the story from Dīgha Nikāya about the person carrying the manure and the other one.
Oh, yes.
Now, where is it?
How
do you, is it on the
serial stage? It is. I think it's a good way to find it. Maybe, let's see if this will work. I'm not sure if it had a...
Is it in commentaries on Dīgha Nikāya?
No, it's in the sutta. See, the problem is that there's too many sutras that have done them. It looks like I need something more specific to find by searching. But yes, in the Dīgha Nikāya, it's in the...
So can you actually mention a specific thing that says just to the specific collection and says just within the Dīgha Nikāya?
To filter the search like that. Yeah, we haven't introduced that yet, but we shouldn't do it. Yeah. That's been on the to-do list for a long time, actually. Where is it? I don't remember the name, but my brain is freezing. Can I ask you that? Can I ask you that? So there's the downstream. Yeah.
Okay, so it looks like we're probably approaching the end of the day's activities. Thank you everyone for your attendance and your attention. And it's been fun, and I hope to be back here soon. And I hope that my voice is better next time. And do we have any like announcements or final words or anything like that anyone wants to make?
Thank you so much.